this meeting, hearing of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee. We're going to take up two bills and act on them very shortly, and then we will proceed to the major purpose for this hearing, which is to consult with the major parties at caucus last Tuesday night, to talk with people who participated. We have someone here from the University of Minnesota, political scientist, and also to hear from a couple of representatives, official representatives of the party. But first, we're going to take these two bills.
Senator Rust, welcome to the committee. We'll hear Senate File 2428 regarding open meetings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 2428 addresses the current statute on the dates of the precinct caucus. As you know, the parties change the time of their meeting for the caucuses, or at least the Independence Party, the Republican Party, and the Democratic Farmer Labor Party to February 5th, but the statute calls for them to meet on March 4th. The Secretary of State's office quite correctly indicated to local governments that the law would prevail on March 4th, which meant that they could not hold meetings, legally binding meetings, after 6 p.m. There are some 70 municipalities that have their meetings on Tuesday evenings, and they would have been prevented from having a meeting not only in February but also one in March. And so what this Senate file does is excuse them for this year only from meeting on March 4th of 2008. As far as I know, all of the representatives of local governments support this bill, and the one party that has chosen to continue with the March 4th date has not expressed any particular objections to local governments being excused from this requirement. If there are questions, there are representatives from the townships and the League of Cities here, but otherwise, if there are no questions, I would move that Senate file
2428.
I don't have an introduced copy.
2428,
you recommended to pass.
Are there any questions from members? Senator Larson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rest, and possibly for Mr. Watson. Are public school athletic events covered in this statute?
Mr. Chairman, the public schools are prohibited from holding a school-sponsored event after 6 p.m. on the day of a major political party precinct caucus. So a school-sponsored event, I think, would include school athletics.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rest, I don't know. I know many times in our schools, that I'm just kind of thinking through this as we're doing this, oftentimes it isn't the school-sponsored event that's occurring in the gymnasium or wherever in the facilities that event is occurring. And I don't know if that's something that over time we can think about, but oftentimes the schools are renting the facilities out to AAU or other community organizations that aren't school-sponsored. So it's just something perhaps for us to think of as we're moving through the process.
Mr.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, I'm kind of curious because the decision to have the caucuses on February 5 was a decision that was made by the political parties, not by the legislature. I'm assuming there were still events and meetings that took place on February 5, even there was no legislation dealing with it. Now they're prohibited from dealing it in March. But I take it that we had some conflicts that night as well, too, in addition to all the other confusion.
Senator Rest?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzold, yes, that is correct. So there would have been no violation on that evening, even though I believe most local governments set aside their meeting times when it became clear that that was the wish of the major political parties.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Any other testimony from the audience? Hearing none, Senator Rest renews her motion that Senate File 2428 be recommended to pass. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next bill I have is Senate File 2511. This is not an elections bill. Last year, we had a bill that repealed any and all obsolete advisory groups and that were affiliated with state agencies, as well as some others, unless the state agency contacted our committee looking at the bill that was proposed and said no, that working group or that advisory committee was indeed still working and active. And if that was the case, then we excluded them from the bill. There were two that missed the notice and contacted us during the interim because, indeed, their authority had been repealed and asked to be reinstated. And this bill simply does that. It is the Healthcare Peer Review Committee that is part of the Corrections Department and the Advisory Committee for the Minnesota Breeders Fund. Changing nothing in law except reinstating them. Nevertheless, the Judiciary Committee does want to take a look at the bill because of the Health Care Peer Review Committee. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 2511 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Are there questions from the committee prior to that motion? Is there any other testimony from the audience? Senator Rust renews her motion that Senate File 2511 be recommended to pass and referred to the Judiciary Committee. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Senator Betzold.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rust, just backing up a second, there seems to be some, I think there might be some urgency in getting the first bill passed. Would it be more appropriate to reconsider that to put on the consent calendar? I think that might move it a little quicker in the process.
Let me finish quick, and Senate File 2511 passes.
No, I'm just suggesting Senator Rest.
I would certainly be open to that. The committee report can't go in until Monday, but to put it on the consent calendar, we at least would be able to pass it on Thursday, I think. So I would move that we reconsider the vote by which 2428 was passed, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we've got a motion to reconsider Senate File 2428. I believe we vote on that motion. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. We have
Mr.
Senate
Chairman,
File 2428 back before us.
Senate File 2428 be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar.
We have a new motion from Senator Rust that Senate File 2428 be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar. Any additional questions on that? All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Same sign. Motion carries.
Well, once again, I want to welcome the public and representatives from the political parties this evening to share with us your experience with our recent political bonanza of participation in Minnesota in the activities leading to selection of our respective presidential candidates and also party organizations. So we did have a bill this past year, Senator Larson's bill, which we have withdrawn from the Finance Committee and brought back into this committee to consider once again, and perhaps based on the experiences of the other evening, suggestions will be coming forth from you or from others to make amendments to that bill to better suit the experiences that Minnesotans already had and that they wish to experience in the future as we have obviously every 4 years a presidential race, but in the interim year, what kind of experiences we want to be possible insofar as law governs it for people participating in their political caucuses. So we have Senate File 1527 back before us. Senator Larson understands that we will not be acting on it this evening, but we wanted a vehicle in front of us so that if anybody wanted to comment on it, they certainly could. So we will begin our hearing tonight with hearing from Mr. Ron Carey, the chairman of the Minnesota Republican Party. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carey. We are very pleased to have you here, and we really do appreciate your taking the time to be with us.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank also the members of the committee for taking or providing this opportunity to share ideas on Minnesota's caucuses and all in like, the shared goal that we want to make sure citizen participation is enhanced in a quality experience for all Minnesotans. I also want to thank the over quarter million Minnesotans who came out on caucus night and also the thousands of people, both Republican and Democrat, who participated as volunteers because this was a very robust evening. It took a lot of people in both all parties to make sure this night was what I think a success. I've been attending caucuses since 1976 when I was 17 years old, and I have never seen anything so exhilarating and exciting as I saw on February 5th this year. This was, again, just an epitome of success, I think, in so many ways of what we want to achieve, and I'm glad we have a chance to talk about what worked well and what we need to work on to improve to make sure the experience is as positive as possible for all. But I think there's confusion surrounding the role and purpose of precinct caucuses. I mean, the purpose of precinct caucuses is not to elect candidates to public office. And I've, you know, heard some suggest while there's elections going on, they weren't monitored or by government or with any kind of structure from the government. And as far as I know, not one person is raising their hand to take an oath of office based upon any caucus vote taken last week. Caucuses really are internal party events that are run by private organizations, political parties. Caucuses are designed to start a process for parties to select their endorsed candidates for all offices, from president all the way down to local races like city council and school boards. Caucuses are designed to select party leaders to lead local party activities. Caucuses are designed to begin a process that determines a party's principles and beliefs that is manifested in a document that we call the party platform. Now, my feeling is that government has no rightful role in telling a private organization, such as a political party, how to select its leaders or statement of principles. Imagine the outcry if the government decided to tell the local Lions Club or local Rotary how they should govern their own organizations. Also, government does have a rightful role in actual election of public office holders. Now, this role is currently exercised through our September primary and November general elections. And private party activities prior to these events are not and should not be dictated by the government. Now, let me share a few facts surrounding this issue. A presidential primary, as suggested in this proposed legislation, will not do away with the need to hold precinct caucuses. You know, a primary actually would decrease the turnout at caucuses and therefore put more control into our party's candidate selection and platform creation into the hands of fewer people. And in hearing the arguments against caucuses, it's often been that the fact that caucuses are run by so few people, and that is perceived by most to be a bad outcome, I would argue that a primary would do the exact opposite of what some people want, and it would have fewer people making those decisions because people would participate in a primary and think they have exercised their right, which they have to a certain extent, but they would not exercise their right to participate in all the other business that goes on in our political process outside of a presidential primary. Washington State, for example, has adopted a dual primary caucus process, and though all Washington has roughly the same population as Minnesota, less than 15,000 people attended the February 9th Washington Republican caucus, even though they were having national delegates allocated by those attending. Obviously, in this dual environment, most people participate only in the primary, if at all. Most of us will agree that broader and deeper participation in the political process for all parties is a healthy goal. A dual primary caucus plan accomplishes the exact opposite by having fewer people actually make the decisions as to who will be the endorsed candidates for anything, U.S. Senator, for example, or U.S. Congress, or for state representative or state senate. And that, again, I think is an outcome that I think most of us agree is not a good outcome that we want to have happen. But history shows that a primary in conjunction with a caucus will achieve exactly lower participation in the caucus process. Now, caucuses, conversely, put more power into the hands of average citizens, not the rich and powerful. I use Paul Wellstone as an example. Back in 1989, he began his run for United States Senate. Nobody had heard about him. But he worked through the grassroots retail politics process that we call the precinct caucuses. Even though he didn't have a name ID and he didn't have the money of his opponents, he was able to talk to people one-on-one and use the caucus process as a launching pad to become eventually our United States Senator from Minnesota. And I believe if we would have gone to a process that was more oriented toward a primary, we would not have had the opportunity for somebody like a Senator Wellstone to come forward. And the Republicans have similar examples. I also want to talk about the openness of the process, because there is a misnomer that the caucuses are really run by party insiders. I've just talked to friends in the last few days, and I have a friend, Paul, who went from Maple Grove, who went to his first Republican caucus ever. And he was so proud to call me the next day and talk about how he was not only was elected a delegate, he was also elected co-chair of his precinct. Then I have another example from a friend, Sarah. She's a 17-year-old from Shoreview who went to her first caucus, thrilled about being involved and having a process that she can get engaged in. And she, too, was elected a delegate, but also elected vice chair of her precinct at the age of 17. And my own personal experience is that when I was 17, I was elected a delegate to the Iowa State Convention, my home state, where I was a delegate to the Iowa State Convention for Governor Ronald Reagan. And it's just an example of the caucus process, contrary to popular opinion, is a very open process. We really are looking for people to get involved in a much more intimate way. Another example of success of this recent caucus is that the Republican Party had two of our county organizations in greater Minnesota that were, in effect, dormant. They just didn't have leadership coming forward. And thanks to the caucuses, we had dozens of people in each of those counties come forward to attend precinct caucuses, and now we have leaders that are taking the lead in those counties, probably to the chagrin of the Democrats in those areas, but, you know, coming forward to take leadership and really rebuild a party organization for us in those counties. If we had had a primary, I don't think we would have had dozens of people show up, and we would still have dormant organizations. And I'm sure, you know, the DFL has areas where they are not as strong as they want, and the caucus brings new, fresh blood into the process that they can then capitalize on, or we can capitalize on, to make sure our party structure is strengthened. But, you know, another argument I guess I would have against the proposed legislation is that the primary would create a new unfunded mandate on local governments, which would add to the pressure to raise local property taxes. I mean, some suggest that state government provide funding to support local governments to pay for conducting a presidential primary. But to me, this is a shell game argument, since either solution means Minnesota taxpayers end up footing the bill to run internal affairs of private organizations. I was talking to members of the media last week, and they referred back to 1992, the last time we had a presidential primary, that this body quickly struck down from the law because there was such an outcry from local government about that unfunded mandate to conduct a primary that really is an internal affair of a private organization like a political party. And, you know, when we face such budget pressure as it is, to put another unfunded mandate on local government, it's something I guess I wouldn't want to take that vote and support doing such to the citizens of the state. So, yes, there were challenges faced on caucus night that were largely logistical, but my sentiment is logistics can be adjusted and corrected and don't mean that the process itself is broken. You know, parties actually have an incentive to fix these issues, these logistical issues, or we run the risk of losing valuable citizen involvement that all parties desire. Now, on the day after the caucuses, I was driving north on University Avenue in Senator Betzold's area in Fridley, and, you know, the Fridley Fire Station had a sign out saying, please participate in your caucus on February 5th, and said the Democrats will be caucusing at the Fridley High School, and the Republicans were caucusing, and they gave two locations. Now, this is an example where we chose to have two locations where the Democrats chose to have one, and because of the high turnout, you had this crush of so many people coming to one location instead of two, and that just exacerbated the problem. But, you know, there were so many schools, community centers, and churches that went sat unused on caucus night that could have been used, and I was talking to a longtime party activist today who said, you know, years ago, their caucus or their Senate district met in multiple locations. Now it's all been consolidated down into one, and that's something we as a party need to look at. Have we taken the easy approach and consolidated oftentimes in an organization instead of having multiple locations that would address issues like that many people faced on caucus night? So again, these are logistical issues that parties are incentivized to fix. We as the Republican Party are actually meeting this coming Saturday to discuss some of these issues and have a postmortem on what worked well and what didn't work well, so that if we face a similar situation in future, we're going to be better prepared to make sure the people have a good experience, because we have every desire to make sure people have nothing but a positive experience when they take the time to come out to caucus, because we need those people engaged in the process. So in conclusion, I would say that our caucus process really empowers average citizens who choose to participate, you know, onto the on-ramp of rich citizen democracy. So my suggestion is, instead of attempting to diminish a grassroots process that rewards citizen participation, we should work together to address logistical issues as private organizations. And I believe that unwelcome government interference in the operation of private organizations, compounded with the added fiscal burden to an already overtaxed Minnesota citizenry, is simply the wrong path for this body to consider going forward. So I do want to commend you for creating this opportunity for us to have this discussion. But I think that the system, you know, they always say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And we have logistical issues that need to be fixed. But I think a presidential primary is the wrong solution to the situation that exists. And I would like to suggest that you let the parties have a chance of seeing if we can't work on making sure the experience going forward is the rich, robust experience that we all desire. So thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to share tonight.
Well, thank you, Mr. Carey. I think you've raised every flashpoint issue of the controversy that I think all of us have become only too familiar with in the last week, as we read the op-ed pieces, as we hear people being interviewed, including yourself, on the radio and TV, about where people feel the caucus system fell short of being inviting and actually making the decisions that people felt that they were going to those caucuses to do, and then but then looking at the experience of other states that either try only to have a primary with no citizen or no party involvement in caucuses, or when they try and have them separately, which some have suggested would be the way to go, to have a presidential primary for that particular purpose once every 4 years, and otherwise to use the caucuses for the purposes of local endorsements and party organization. I'm intrigued, and I understand from your general approach that the we would have to weigh very carefully the cost and benefit of paying for a presidential primary and additional election. In Senator Larson's bill, it is a cost that is absorbed by the general public and not local governments, so it is a cost to the state taxpayers. But in terms of interference, if you will, with party decisions, do you think that we ought to repeal the law that sets the parameters for participation in precinct caucuses. Is that not in and of itself an invasion? And should we, we used to have March 4th, which we dealt with tonight, telling other local governments that for the sake of a political party, activities that they could not meet. Would you also support that, or is there a different rationale for why we have that would be different than offering at least the opportunity for a non-binding presidential primary?
Well, Chairman Melendez of the DFL party and I met last year about this issue, and we consulted with our respective legal counsel. And both parties came back to the same conclusion that as private entities and organizations, the state really doesn't have the right to dictate when we meet and how we meet. And that's where we, in meeting with Secretary of State Ritchie, made the decision to move our dates, because I think there's just a general concept that we are organized legally like the Lions Club, and the government has little to no ability to tell us how to run our internal operations. Now, I understand that when it comes to selecting candidates in a general election or a primary, that's where the government, you know, does have a role to step in and play a role in that. But at this point in time, this is part of our internal process that we have to select who we want to bring forward to the voters of Minnesota. Not as we can endorse somebody, it doesn't mean they're going to be on the ballot.
Right.
And so that's where we have the September primary, and we respect that.
My question is more, should we repeal the law that's on the books that sets aside March 4th and prohibits, public bodies activities after 6 o'clock at night, which if you're like the Lions Club, this is a law that would favor the Lions Club.
Right.
Should we have a law that favors private clubs, if you will, or private organizations, and in order to encourage civic engagement, civic participation in a private organization's activities? And what's the difference if we said that there would be a presidential primary in which a private club mm-hmm. could choose to participate or not? What's the difference?
Well, you can certainly give the option. I guess the question is, do taxpayers want to pay for that, especially if it's non-binding? Because, I mean, you're basically having a beauty contest that is being paid for by the taxpayer. And to me, as a taxpayer myself, that's not exactly how I prefer to have my tax dollars be spent.
Should we repeal the current law?
I would recommend, both Chairman Melendez and I have agreed that the law really is something that should be repealed, and we acted upon as if the law didn't exist this year based on recommendations from our legal counsel that the state really could not hold us to a specific date. So, that's where I would certainly recommend that let's just get in sync with what reality is from a legal standpoint, that the state government cannot tell private organizations like political parties when they can hold their internal meetings.
And they should not require another government to kowtow to a political party and not hold their legally required meetings like last Tuesday night.
That's something would certainly be the right of the government not to do that. Obviously, as an organization, we'd love to have the playing field cleared so we're the only show in town that
sure.
night.
Mm-hmm.
But, should government do that, I would not argue with your thoughts that we are private organizations, and I know when the Lions meet, you don't just close things down for the Lions Club. But I think we're looking
point.
At the general goal. Mm-hmm. Specifically, is it good to have broader participation? That's why I think those steps were taken in the first place, just to encourage more citizen participation. But if it's not there, I think those who really care. I mean, we all set priorities. I mean, I had to sit down this week and decide, do I want my son to play in Little League this year, knowing the commitment was going to make to the family. And I think it's the same thing. If people have to make decisions as to mm-hmm. do they want to attend caucuses and make that a priority in their lives, or do they want to do something else?
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to chime in on the thought on that, because I think the question you asked is a fascinating one, a fundamental one about this.
It is.
I think it's
a
great question.
Right.
So I was trying to think, I'll run through all the scenarios in my mind. What is a fundamental difference? And I think it's something to consider. I could be wrong, but I think that one is the current law with the meetings being exempt, the current law, that enhances what the parties are doing. It enhances it. The proposal, the bill that we're talking about, places a restriction and one could argue detracts from, places a, you know, pulls something out of the caucuses about how they do their business. So I think that might be a fundamental reason. One is the current law is something that enhances it. One is something takes it away from it. So I think that laws that will enhance the caucuses probably are positive and good. So I think the current law is probably good. Keep the meetings, you know, off the calendar so people can go to caucuses. But I think that laws that will take away abilities for once you're meeting of certain things that you're going to do, I think that that would be a detraction or take some away. I think that would be a negative. Just my perspective.
Senator Bessel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Chairman Kerry, you mentioned my particular area, and up in Blaine, which is the better part of my district, I was up there that night, and the Democrats and the Republicans both have their caucus there. Most years it works because it doesn't matter what political party, just show up, everybody knows where to go, and we kind of sort you out when you get there. But with the crunch of people that we had, there probably was no facility anywhere around that, number one, would have handled this kind of a crowd, or two, we would have the volunteers in either party to have dealt with them. But that's a different issue. But I'm very curious about one item, and this you may be in your position uniquely able to evaluate this. This probably was a once-in-a-generation event where we had a situation where we did not have an incumbent president, there was no obvious nominee from either party, and we were early enough in the process so people felt that my participation or my vote mattered. Even if they were going to just show up and vote and leave, it mattered. But, of course, in Minnesota, Governor Romney did very well in the Republican caucuses, but then he suspended his campaign 2 days later. I'm just wondering if you have any sense of, you know, in the aftermath, how that might have affected participation in the Republican caucuses. I mean, if it would have been even 1 week later, would that have skewed, you know, for instance, participation in the Republican caucus turnout?
No, good question, Senator. Thanks for asking. And no question, the competitive nature of both races really spurred turnout on both sides there. And if there was a perception on the Republican side that it wasn't as competitive, it probably would have dampened participation. I don't know how much. It's only speculation. I mean, the Governor Romney situation is one of the reasons we chose not to go with a binding election because as the results came out, Governor Romney probably would have received all of our delegates if we had bound them. Only to 36 hours after that binding, he would have suspended his campaign and put all of our delegates into kind of a state of limbo at this point in time. And right now we haven't selected a single delegate, so therefore we can have the flexibility to allocate our delegates to the realities of who is actually competitive in our races as we get closer to the nominating convention here in St. Paul. So I think what we did, I think, was proven right away to be something that's very wise in not binding our delegates with the realities of the political process. But no question, I think what we saw this time was the first time since 1952 we had a situation where it wasn't a sitting president or vice president running for either party. And that the fact that we moved it up did accomplish what we wanted. We were involved, and people in Minnesota had a chance to participate in a very competitive environment. It did spark greater turnout. I would like to tell you that both parties will see the same turnout in 2 years or 4 years. Probably not likely. And that's where, again, we may be shooting at a target that's already past us when you talk about some of the issues here, and we may not see that again. I think that the lesson is that if we see a situation developing in either party that seems to have that perfect storm scenario like we saw this year, we better take some steps. So instead of having one location in Blaine, we have three locations, you know, using other schools or facilities to make sure that we don't have everybody trying to converge on one spot and creating the gridlock that people found in some of those locations. I know in my own Senate district, you know, we meet in multiple locations. And you know, simple things that we did, like in my city, we had six precincts met in six different parts of a school. Parking lot was a little full, but everybody got in. But what we did, too, is that we had registration decentralized in each of the six precincts. So instead of having one central location where everybody got gridlock as they came in the door and sometimes standing out the door down, you know, in the cold, we did something that actually worked real well because people came into their own individual precinct and registration worked real fast. And those are little kind of tweaks that I think we as parties can do with the lessons we learned this time to make sure that people do have a better experience. And so, again, as a political party, we have every incentive, as I said earlier, to get this fixed. So if we ever face a situation similar to this, and I hope we do, I hope we have more people next time, that we logistically are ready to handle in this situation and give everybody a really robust and rich experience that they want to come back and stay engaged more intimately in the political process.
Mr. Carey, I have one final question, and we really do want to hear from others.
Yes.
If cost was not an issue, would the Republican Party have any objection to the Democratic or the Independence Party having a caucus and a presidential primary if cost is an issue? I understand that. But if cost was not an issue, it was just a matter of public policy to be permissive with that regard, would the Republican Party in general, do you think, have any problem with the with other major parties having participating in a voting situation rather than just a caucus?
Well, you're asking a hypothetical question that really is not possible, because if you do have an election, there will be cost involved. And as I think we would oppose it philosophically that tax dollars are being spent to support elections that are internal party affairs.
Okay.
And so I don't think that we really can ever get to an agreement on that.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Carey. We really
do
appreciate your being with us tonight. Next, I would like to invite Mr. Craig Swaggart, who is the chairman of the Minnesota Independence Party, to join us.
It's perfect timing.
Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Craig Swaggart, I'm the state chair of the Independence Party.
Thank you for joining us, and we
thank
love
you
to hear
for
from you.
Inviting us, me. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're in kind of a unique situation because we are a state party and focus on state issues. We would support a presidential primary because many of our members don't have the opportunity, although they vote for a president, they don't have the opportunity to have input on presidential candidates. I think that some... to speak to one of Mr. Carey's, Chairman Carey's issues about regulating parties, I think that you brought up, Madam Chair, you brought up a good point that we are regulated. And it's the degree of regulation that we need, that we have to talk about. And a couple of the things that personal experiences I had with this process revolved more around people that did not come to our caucus, that were very frustrated because they were unable to vote as they thought they were doing if they could get to a caucus. Several people I talked to expressed a concern that, one, that they couldn't get there at the time that was allotted, and some of them had to work. Some of them didn't have rides. I think it's that we all have the goal of more voter participation. And when I see the presidential race as something that's outside of our state more than just a state issue. And I think that we can, by having a presidential primary, we can have more participation. And one of the things that the three major parties agreed on was to move the caucus date up so it would have more relevance. I think that the primary would increase that relevance because there would be stronger participation. And
what was the total participation in the Independence Party?
Well, we have the virtual caucus still going on, so we don't have the numbers yet.
Would you explain what that process is and how that came about?
That came about mostly because we wanted to include as many people as we could, and we felt that there were a lot of people that were excluded because of the very narrow time frame that caucuses are scheduled for, and so we We do a virtual caucus that is essentially the same as a caucus. That, and you can put forth platform changes that would be recommended. You can register as a delegate if there's openings to further conventions, the central committee and the state conventions. So you can essentially do the same thing you do on at a caucus, mm-hmm. but you don't have the one of the. We're trying to work on something where we have more interaction, and
so
that's
that
one of the great
Mr.
things
Tiger,
about
caucus. Is
that
caucus. All done online? Is
yes, it's all done online.
And what is your current experience with that?
We have more participation in the virtual caucus than we do in our physical caucus.
It's
growing every year. We've had it. This is our third time doing it, and it's mm-hmm. it's doubled just about every year. If we keep going at this rate, we'll be in eight times. We'll be at a very high level of participation. But I think it's one of the ways of the future.
Okay. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Swigert, Senator Betzel?
Thank you. I do have a question. As long as we have you here, even though we're not going to be apparently taking action tonight. If we were to have a presidential primary, one of the questions that would have to be raised is, should it be an open primary or a closed one? That is, you know, do you have to declare your party affiliation, or should anybody be able to show up, any voter, and vote? And, of course, you know, I have a hunch, you know, as the chair of the Independence Party, if you did not have a candidate, you would certainly want your members of your party to be able to vote wherever they felt. But if you did have a candidate, as, say, Ross Perot was a candidate in the forerunner of what is now the Independence Party, you might have an interest in that. So I'm kind of curious as to where you would feel we should do if we ever got to that question.
Mr. Swagger.
Pardon?
We just need to go through the chair, so I need to call on you each
you.
Time you speak. So, Mr. Swagger.
Thank you. Senator, to address that question, I would say an open primary. And I would say that not only because of the Independence Party, but in the last poll that was taken, there were 38% of Minnesotans consider themselves independent. If in a primary, you only get one vote, so whether it's open or closed, people would be able to switch. And I'm not sure what you're referring to as a closed.
Well,
Senator Betzel, you want to describe
I think a closed
that.
Primary would be only people who have identified themselves, you know, with a particular party. Could vote in that one. You'd have to declare yourself mm-hmm. a member of a party, and I don't know how each state does it, but you might only get the ballot of the party that you've identified with, you know, to vote on that. I think one of the problems maybe with the open one is that if one party's candidate is pretty much decided, there might be an incentive for people to cross over and vote for a weaker candidate just to embarrass maybe the front runner of the other party. But, you know, so there's pros and cons of doing this. So I'm just kind of curious as to your take on this.
Mr. Sprecher.
Thank you. There's always that possibility, even in a caucus, that there are people that could cross over. If a sitting president was running, that you'd have the same situation that you're speaking of right now. And we have an open process here where we don't have to register as a Democrat or Republican. And so we have this large group of people that do not consider themselves a member of any party. And so depending on the candidate, they can cross over.
Thank you very much, Mr. Swigert. Are there any further questions or comments from Mr. Swigert? Thank you very much for joining us. Mr. Melendez, so the chair of the DFL party, neither he nor Donna Cassett, who is the associate chair, were available, or they informed us they were not available to come. But they did, or somebody from the Central Party did invite and contact Senate District Chairs in the Yes, Senate district chairs, and then also a congressional district chair to come and give a kind of an overview of the experience of the caucuses in their respective districts. And so I think I'm going to, so it doesn't look like we're kind of ganging up, that I'll ask three of you to come up at a time, and then we'll just ask you to speak briefly about your experience, what recommendations you would make either to the state and to your party for changes, or whether you would make no change. We really are interested not only in your experiences but in your opinions about whether Minnesota should change its system. So I would invite P.J. Boise and just in the way they're listed here, which Senate District 37, Norb Gurnas, Senate District 42, and Larry Fonas, the chair of Senate District 45, which actually is my Senate district, but he is here not at my invitation, although he could have certainly come at my invitation. He's here at the invitation of the state party. So, gentlemen, if you would maybe first let us know where your Senate district is and how many people you had at your caucus, where you had them, again, the experience. Do you see the need for any change? What would you recommend both to the state and to your own party? Mr. Boise, we'll begin with you. And if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Hi, my name is...
And as each of you gentlemen sign in the our page, Ms. Sands has left the sign-in sheet there for you. Mr. Boise.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is P.J. Boise. I'm from Senate District 37, which is Apple Valley, Rosemont, and the east part of Burnsville, and I'd like to say hi to my senator, Senator Gerlach. Thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. I'll try and do this quickly. I was told to expect 1,200 people, which would be double our previous record, and then a week before they upped it to 1,500. We prepared for maybe 1,500 to 2,500 on various documents. We had 3,000 people attend. I believe that we were very well organized. We had traffic. We were at Apple Valley High School, and we actually had the lobby roped off so that as people came in the front door, instead of just milling around in the lobby, we actually had almost like a bank teller queue where people had to wind around through the school. And we had it set up so that we could probably accommodate about 150 people lined up inside the school. And we had allowed candidates to have tables on either side of that so that every candidate would have equal access to the line and so on. So they wound around, had been maybe 150 in the school, and then there was a cutoff point where we had... four stations, depending on if you're in Apple Valley East or West, or if you're in Burnsville or Rosemont, and we had paper precinct finders. We had 17 of them printed up on tables for each of those four stations. So we had people at various points doing crowd control, and so you'd get to a point, somebody would tell you which table to go to. You'd go to the table, there'd be this 10-page booklet where you would find your street, then the house number, odd or even, it would tell you your precinct. Then there was another table that would say your precinct was in room number such and such. I believe that was set up really well. There are things that we could do differently with hindsight that we could make that process go faster, but we checked in 3,000 people through that process in a little under 2 hours. So we got people out of that area as quickly as possible to the precincts. We didn't have a central gathering space. And then they did the formal registration in the precincts. We had pre-printed presidential preference ballots. And according to the DFL call, you were allowed to get your ballot, register, get your ballot, and then vote and leave immediately if you wanted. We had a line out.
Might just indicate that the official call, I don't know if they do the same in the other parties, is a document adopted by the party, which are the rules and regulations for precinct caucuses and also the operations of Senate district conventions and indeed leading up into the state convention. So it's an official document that's adopted by the party.
Thank you. Like I said, I believe this was very well organized from a crowd control point of view. My wife arrived somewhere between 7 and 7:30 in the evening, and she said that the line was 200 yards out the door. It took her 20 minutes to get all the way in, find her precinct, register, vote, and then she left immediately. So I don't think 20 minutes is too bad, to get in. The issue that we had was that it was parking and traffic. I found out afterwards that cars were lined up more than a mile in each direction. I found out afterwards through emails that there were a lot of people that couldn't make it to the event because of the overwhelming traffic. We could have held this in multiple locations, and the problem with that is we're a volunteer organization, and we just didn't have the staff. There's no way. I would have had to quit my job for the couple of months leading up to this thing. I would have had to have two or three times as many people up front helping organize it, and then I probably would have had to have three times as many volunteers to manage multiple locations. I would also have to have, if we split it up into, say, three locations, I'd have to have some mechanism to inform the voting public which precincts would be at which locations. There was also confusion. People went to, the City of Apple Valley's website, went to the election page, found their precinct, found out where their precinct votes, and then went to that location. And this wasn't an election, as Mr. Kerry said. This wasn't an election. This was a party caucus. But that is lost on a lot of the population. Essentially, this was a primary. I'll agree with some comments that Mr. Kerry made that it might be decades before we see this kind of turnout again. I've heard comments that people say that the turnout that we had was similar to the turnout that we would have at a primary. So my comment is, if we just had a primary, maybe we would have, instead of having 400,000 people engaged, I've heard that there were 250,000 DFLers and 150,000 Republicans. So we had at least 400,000 people participate. If this was a primary, maybe 1.2 or 1.5 million people would have participated. If we're going to consider this to be internal party business or a private organization like the Lions Club, then we shouldn't have the restrictions that we have on the parties. I mean, I don't think we tell the Lions Club how much money. I don't think we limit how much money people can donate to the Lions Club. There's all sorts of regulations that govern what I can and cannot do as a party chair. For example, there is a list that I'm allowed to give a list of delegates to candidates that are seeking the party's endorsement, but I'm not allowed to give them the email address. And my understanding of that is because certain information is public record and certain is not. I don't think we tell the Lions Club, you're not allowed to give people certain information, and you can give them other information. So we're governing this thing differently already. So I think it's unfair to compare it to the Lions Club. And I'll just leave it at that because I know you've got a lot of people that you want to hear from tonight.
I have one question. The party caucuses were governed by a set of rules. To what extent do you think the caucuses, the precinct caucuses in your Senate district, followed the rules to the T? Did you allow voting after 8 o'clock? Did you vote on other than pre-printed ballots? Did you accept ballots that were cast by people who were voting in the wrong precincts? Are you sure that you did not allow people to vote twice?
Boy, there's a lot of questions in there, Madam Chair.
Now, those are the rules.
First of all, my understanding of the DFL call that you very eloquently described earlier is that the DFL call does not specify pre-printed ballots. So you can actually bring post-it notes, for example, or just tear up pieces of paper, and that's all handled locally within the precincts. If there are any challenges, if somebody, for example, says, hey, I don't think this person lives in my precinct, a discussion is held at that precinct level, just like any other motion, and with three people speaking before, four and three people speaking against, and then the body, that precinct, would vote, and that precinct would determine by a majority whether...
Was there anyone who was challenged that you're aware of?
I'm not aware of any challenges. I'm not aware of... it's possible that people voted twice. I'm not aware of any blatant abuse or any blatant disregard for the way the caucus was governed. To answer your original question...
Did you allow people to vote after 8 o'clock?
We cut off voting. What we did was... yes, we did. We cut off. We made the decision to cut off voting at 8:15 instead of 8 o'clock, and the way we determined that was the line finally at the front door finally dissipated a little before 8 o'clock, and by 8 o'clock you could have walked in the front door and gone straight through to the precinct finder with no line. So we ran around. We couldn't use the PA system in the school. So we ran around to all the precincts and said, anybody that's in line by 8:15 is allowed to vote. But I don't think that was an issue. I ran around to half, and my daughter ran around to the other half, and there was only one precinct where there was somebody that was sitting there arguing because it was after 8 o'clock. So pretty much the voting was done by 8 o'clock, but we did extend it to 8:15.
Okay.
And by the way, and we started at 6. We opened the doors and started registration at 6 p.m. The call states that... registration can start anytime after 6:30, and as soon as you're registered, you can get your ballot and go. However, the call does not state whether that's p.m. or a.m., and so I took the liberty, because I already had a line out the door at 6 o'clock, so I took the liberty to interpret that as 6 a.m., and I extended it by half an hour. And I just,
creative.
In the interest of full disclosure here.
Very creative.
I am very interested in all your experiences. I don't mean to dominate the questioning, and I hope that my questions reflect questions that other people may have too. But I don't want to do that, Senator Betzel.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a question, I guess, for all the people who are going to be testifying tonight. I think most people would agree that this year on this date, it would have been helpful to have had, an election day, because there was a lot of people who wanted to vote. I mean, that was the experience for this time. But we're trying to look ahead 4 years, 8 years, 12 years, and so forth down the road. So what should we do, if anything, for the next couple of presidential cycles? Should we have the caucus system as we know it now? Should we also have a presidential primary? What changes should we make, if any? And that's for all the testifiers tonight.
Mr. Boyce, we'll start with you, and then we'll go on to the other folks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Betzold. My recommendation is to have a presidential primary, and maybe even to have an early primary for state and local offices. The thing is, a lot of people that came to our primary, to our caucus, we were estimating that 1,300 out of the 3,000 actually stayed for caucus. And that's based on just how many rooms we had and that they were all filled to capacity. The thing is, a lot of the people that I spoke to, and again, I don't know if it's 50%, but a huge portion of the population that came to this caucus basically thought they were coming to a primary and treated it like a primary election. So I think we should just have a primary.
Thank you very much, Mr. Boyce.
Thank you.
Gernis, would you describe where your Senate district is, and we would welcome your comments also along the lines that Mr. Boyce, the topics that he covered. And first of all, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Okay, Madam Chair. My name is Norbert Gernis, and I'm the chair of Senate District 42, which is the southern half of Minnetonka and all of Eden Prairie. And our
and
caucus.
Your senator is, what, the senator for that district, 42, yeah.
Is Han.
David Han. And the two representatives are?
Maria Rood and Paulson.
Maria Rood and Representative Eric Paulson.
Paulson.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Okay. And our caucus was at the high school, the Republicans as well as the Democrats caucus at the Eden Prairie High School. And in the past, that has always worked very well. The highest number that we had for a attendance in the past was 900 people. And knowing the numbers were high this year, we prepared for 2,000. And then when we saw what was happening across the country, we upped that and got paperwork ready for 3,000. And we had over 4,000 people come into the Democratic caucus. The Republicans also hit a high record of, I believe they had 1,100 people cast votes for the president on their side. In addition to that, there was a full slate of high school activities in the building, ball games, plays, concerts. And so the Republican Party and our party got together ahead of time and rented 240-passenger buses to serve as shuttle buses to go around and contacted the local churches and parks. So we had shuttle buses going around to bring people in, and we worked together on that.
From remote parking spots, is that
we had arrangements with several of the churches, plus there's a park nearby, plus there's a little shopping center. And so we had the buses circulating and dropping people off, and we had taped down the halls to follow the blue line to get to the Democrats, follow the red line to get to the Republicans. So it was a cooperative effort, but it still totally overwhelmed us in terms of numbers. As I said, with the highest we'd had before was 900. We had announced that we would have a general gathering at 6 o'clock, and then the registration could start at 6:30 with the caucuses convening at 7. People started pouring through the doors by 5:30, and they never stopped pouring through the doors in a solid stream until after 8:30.
I'm curious about the I hadn't heard about precinct caucus locations or the political parties having remote parking, like going to the state fair or something. How did people know about that? Did you just tell them when they drove up, or did you had signs up or on radio, or what'd you do?
Okay, the local newspapers were very cooperative in publishing some articles indicating where the parking would be. We got a bunch of the old real estate signs, the tent ones, and put signs on there in reflective tape that indicated, this way to overflow parking and shuttle bus that way. And we had, I think, 38 of those signs around to direct people to the various church lots and the park lots. And even at that, it was totally inadequate. And I think we can, if the numbers come anywhere close to that again, we can never do that again. We have to break it up into smaller units. I think, obviously, what the fire chief told me and the police and the press, because I wasn't outside of the building, but they said that we had traffic backed up all the way into Chanhassen, which is almost 3 miles away on State Highway 5. We were backed up from Eden Prairie, almost State Highway 5, almost back into Glen Lake, which is almost another 3 miles another way, and Valley View Road was completely shut down for, I think, over 2 hours. So in addition to the people who made it into our caucus, the estimates run anywhere from 500 to 1,000 people who gave up and never made it in. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it was bad news. I think the good news is we have worked long and hard to try to get citizens involved in politics and understand that they are responsible for choosing who governs us. And I feel kind of like we finally found the goose that laid the golden egg, and so I hope we're not going to go out and kill it. I think that we had a tremendous turnout, and in terms of when I saw the numbers coming in, I was anticipating that I would be dealing with lots and lots of angry people, and that did not turn out to be the case. I ended up dealing with two fairly disturbed individuals. I mean, angry, not disturbed, but maybe they were disturbed at the caucus, and that was all. The people, as they were leaving, there were hundreds of people who gave us the thumbs up and said, great organization. And I thought it was out of control, but they were saying how well it was organized, how good it was, how pleased they were. In emails afterwards, I had two emails that went to the state and were sent back to me from people who were upset, and I believe I had two that came directly to me. That's all I had in way of complaints. I have had hundreds and hundreds of positive comments. They had to be, I don't know, somewhere between 30 to 1 to 50 to 1 positive over negative comments about the caucus. It was, and I think, an example of, and there were mistakes. People went to the wrong place. We had one man who we discovered registered in the wrong caucus, and I'm sure he voted in that caucus, precinct, I should say, and we found that, and he was elected a delegate. We found that there was room in his own precinct so he could be a delegate. We called him up and let him know that he was 78 years old, and he went on to say how excited he was that he thought, you know, nobody else in his neighborhood was ever interested in politics. He was ecstatic to see the neighbors who were there to find out what this was about. He said, I am so proud to have been a part of this event. So even though it was frustrating, I think, for many of us, myself included, I think the overall experience was exceedingly positive. And the thing that I would see that we need to do is to find maybe two or three or four locations to hold our caucuses in on a future time. I guess I see the caucus as a very important tool for getting people involved, and without that, I don't know how we would bring people together to get them active in neighborhoods in the community. And I think it isn't just for the national offices or the state offices that is important. I believe that the local political parties also recruit and get people on city commissions, on cities, and we've worked with a couple of the different cities this year for people going on their city councils, and we have several school districts in our district. We worked with people to get good people on the school boards. I think all of those not only serve the local community, but I think that also then prepares people, gives them some experience so that they can move on, you know, up the line at a later time. I do agree that the way it was, the time period, you know, from 6:30 to 8 means that those who have to work or otherwise are occupied during that time, it's a very narrow window for people to come and voice their choice for that the candidate of their party. But you know, it is not at that point it's not a public election at that point. This is a party endorsement. But I can see some reasons to have a more general thing so more people could vote. However, I think the caucus system is a tremendous asset. I think and I guess with any system, it's going to be as good as the citizens are and probably as informed as they are. But I would support our keeping the caucus system. Thank you.
Questions?
Senator Bissell. Just to be clear, again, we're trying to look ahead. What do you think we should do? Should we have a presidential primary or not? 4 years, 8 years, 12 years down the road, what should we be thinking of?
I would tend to favor keeping it with the caucus. I think if we spread it out, we can avoid the crowding that kept people from voting. And I realize it does open it up to more people to vote. So I think it's kind of a... not totally clear in my mind, but if you push me for a vote right now, I would go for the caucus system.
Madam Chair, just to be clear,
we could, as
Mr. Kerry indicated, Washington State has the caucuses, but they also have a presidential primary. So theoretically, you know, both could be done. We could have had a primary election and still had the caucuses. So it's not necessarily either or, but should we also have a presidential primary election? Because apparently that's what a lot of people want to do. They just want to show up, vote, and leave, and that really wasn't what the caucus system was designed to do.
And indeed, Senator Larson's bill permits the continuation of the caucus system. It just adds a non-binding presidential primary.
Okay, without giving that a lot of thought and investigation, I guess I would say that that would sound like a reasonable system to have a general vote for the president and then still have the caucus system, as long as we're still able to continue that part of the organization.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Gernis. Mr. Larry Fonest is the Senate District Chair for District 45. And as I indicated, the chair of my Senate District, Mr. Fonest, if you would describe our Senate District and then the experiences that We had, I know, one already difference is we were allowed to use the PA system in the school that our caucuses were held in, and I thought that was very valuable. Mr. Fonis, and wait, if you'd identify yourself, please.
Of course. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Larry Fonis, Senate District Chair for DFL 45, includes Northern Golden Valley, Robbinsdale, Crystal, New Hope, and Eastern Plymouth. And our experience was not unlike the previous speakers. We were better organized and prepared for larger numbers, but we were surprised by the number of people who came through the front door. We were informed by the school principal, by the way, we held this at Sandberg Middle School in Golden Valley and have held our caucuses there for a number of years. We were informed by the principal that over the course of the day, over 250 people had shown up to vote, thinking that it was a very standard voting process. And many were upset when they were told that they would have to return later that evening. We had prepared for 15,000 to 2,000 people, well above anything we had ever experienced. We had 3,571 people register and vote that evening, and we managed to move folks through the building into their precinct caucuses in a fairly efficient manner. It's surprising to me even now that so few people know their precincts or how our system of government operates, or maybe not our government, but our party systems. It was a very exciting evening. There were a lot of younger people who showed up, a lot of people that I have not seen out in the community before. And it was really good to see the breadth of people that were there. As was described earlier, traffic congestion was a major problem. If you know the Golden Valley area, we had cars stretching from Highway 100 all the way up to the school, which is about 8 blocks away from the freeway. 36th Avenue, which is just north of the Golden Valley Duluth Street exit, was jammed. The police were called in to help direct traffic, and we had people parking as much as 8 blocks away. Folks took full advantage of the Honeywell parking lot, which is very near the school, which was a godsend. And all in all, though, we were very pleased in terms of our planning. This could have been a meltdown, given the number of people that showed up, but it worked well, and we, as was mentioned earlier, received a lot of compliments that evening. In terms of the enthusiasm that people brought to the experience, their patience in working through the lines and getting to their rooms and registering and voting. Our rooms proved to be too small to handle the crowds that were there. A lot of people did vote and leave, and I think that some left with disappointment, hoping that they could spend the evening and offer resolutions or the like, but the rooms just couldn't accommodate the number of people that we had. To your question, Senator Rest, made an announcement over the PA system at 8 o'clock that balloting was to conclude shortly, that anyone that was still in line to register was to be allowed to vote, but that the votes were to be collected and then run up to the front of the school for counting as soon as that line had dissipated. That worked quite well. But there were people who did not make it into the building and register before the event came to a close. We had people arriving at 8:30 who still wanted to register and vote, and by then the call had already gone out to collect the ballots. So in that way, there were folks who were, if you will, perhaps disenfranchised from the system. There weren't many, but there were a few. To answer your question, Senator Betzelt, I think that a primary would be a good thing. I think it engages people in their civic responsibility and encourages folks to pay attention to what's going on around them and in their community. I agree with my colleagues that the caucus system serves a purpose, not only for the party, but also in helping to gather citizen input into the party platform through resolutions and the like. I would concur in my own mind with Senator Larson's bill. I've read it. I think it has merit from my perspective. And I think anything that we can do, either as party leaders or as elected officials, to improve upon and encourage citizen participation in our system of government is a good thing.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Fonis?
Yeah,
Senator Betz.
I have one question, and you might be able to answer this one. It wasn't clear to me, were the Republican and DFL caucuses at the same location, or were you in separate locations?
We were in separate locations.
Okay. Do you have any sense what the Republican caucus location was like? Did they have the same traffic jams and so forth, or were you close enough that it mattered, or were you split apart that it didn't?
Madam Chair, Senator, I have only secondhand information. I heard their numbers were around 1,200. They were at the high school, I think. I would assume that it was a little more manageable.
Okay.
Much larger parking lot, obviously, because students drive to school.
Okay.
Much larger building and so forth. Senator Gerlach and then Senator Rowling.
Oh, Madam Chair. Actually, I live right outside Apple Valley High School where you were having your caucuses, so I had to fight my way through all those Democrats. Get out of that traffic.
It was good for you. It was very good for you.
And then get to my traffic jam to get in. So it took quite a while. But one thing is I've heard a couple testifiers about the confusion about people thinking they were just going to vote, that they showed up at their actual voting precincts, that they thought this was a primary election, that there were hundreds of calls and this sort of thing. I didn't experience that from any Republicans at any of the caucuses. I mean, I didn't have anybody that I'm aware of from anecdotal evidence or anybody that thought, well, I thought this was a primary. I didn't see that. What was different with the maybe Mr. Boise knows. What was different?
Mr. Boise, if you have a
thank you, Madam
response.
Chair. Thank you, Senator. I don't know if Kevin can do anything about this, but the presidential campaigns on the Democratic side were running ads on the radio and on the web that went something like this. This is Senator Obama. Vote for change. Show up. Go to your precinct caucus. Polls open at blah, blah, blah time. Vote for change, and so there was a lot of hype around that from the candidates that gave people the impression that polls opened at different. Yeah, they would use the word poll. So there was a lot of hype like that from campaigns, and then I think just generally there is somebody in the room here said this earlier. A lot of the citizens don't really understand how the caucus process works. I'm a Senate District Chair. There's a lot of things that I don't know, and the first precinct caucus I ever went to was 2 years ago, and I had no idea what caucus was until I got in, just like a lot of people don't understand the Electoral College system, there's a lot of people that just don't understand how this process works. And I apologize
Senator
for
Gerlach,
the...
Do you have a follow-up question?
Different one.
Okay.
I just want to ask a couple of quick questions to try to understand, because for consistency here, are each of the three of you glad about the turnout? Are you happy that you had that large turnout, or would you have preferred a lesser turnout? Which are you glad you had the turnout you had? Simple question. You're all nodding.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Everybody is glad they had it.
They all nodded.
Yes. Now my assumption is that what drove the numbers was the presidential straw balloting, the presidential campaign. There was, of course, some advertising. We all did. Am I wrong on that assumption, that that's what drove the turnout?
Yes. No, you're correct in your assumption.
Mr. Gernis?
I think you're partially right. I think the Senate campaign also drove tremendous numbers because the campaigns were running like classes and sessions, training people how to go to caucus and how to get to become delegates. So in addition to what was said about the presidential ads, I think we also had the Senate, and in okay. our area we also have the congressional, the House seat. We have three strong candidates in the third CD also running training programs for people on how to become delegates. So all those put together, plus the good job we did, counted for the large number. Okay.
Well, that certainly can, certainly those sort of competitive races at the state level can drive turnout as well. But I think that what put it off the charts, because we've had competitive Senate races, we've had competitive legislative races and such, but what really put it off the chart clearly was this presidential race. I mean, I think that's probably not really disputed. I mean, that's what was really different this year.
Can I talk to that, Madam Chair?
Yes, and then we do want to hear from the next set of Senate District Chairs.
I think, Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, I think you are correct that the presidential, this unique, unprecedented presidential cycle that we're in really pushed this over the top. In my Senate district, though, if my estimate of 1,300 people that stayed for caucus and to do resolutions and elect delegates and so on, 1,300 people that stayed is still double the previous record caucus attendance.
Okay. So, Madam Chair,
Senator Gerlach,
we had this drive turnout. A lot of them just left, but a whole lot of them also stayed that were brand new to this. But so now my confusion is this. If we're glad about this turnout, and we all agree that we attribute that to the presidential race and the ability to go vote in the straw ballot or whatever people perceive it to be, but it drove that turnout, and that's a good thing, but yet all of you support Senator Larson's bill that would take that away, and we would do that separately. Now, of course, I know you have the option of still doing straw balloting and such, but essentially what really drove the turnout, you're taking away, and if you did that, the caucus turnout that we had would have declined, which you say is something you would not prefer. So I guess I'm trying to connect the dots here. I mean, I don't support Senator Larson's mm-hmm. bill. I want these robust caucuses. I want us to have problems. It sounds like it sounds like they did a phenomenal job. They must have had a crystal ball with some of the logistical planning that many others did not. But that's the reason for those lines of questions. If we're glad for that turnout, and that was a good thing, we wouldn't want to see it go down, but yet we're going to pull away something that drove the turnouts. Okay. What am I missing on that? I guess we see a lot of
hands. Senator Gerlach, I think that even though there were the tremendous organizational efforts, I can tell you that of the number of emails I received, there was a tremendous expression of frustration that the only thing they ever got to was voting, that they didn't get to talk about the Senate candidates, that they didn't get to talk about the congressional delegates, and they don't even know who their legislative candidates are.
So, Madam Chair, then we should have fewer?
And that if that had not been a, that the notion that this was a true caucus is fanciful. That what it was an opportunity to vote in a presidential caucus, or in a presidential caucus, yes, as a matter of fact, and that if it had been a primary, that the numbers would have, for people participating, would have doubled. So is it, to me, the question would be, is it civic engagement and citizen participation that we want in one's party, or is it a particular structure? And that's the question. And can we say that the participation in the primary, in a primary, if we had one, is somehow of suspect participation, where as opposed to going to a caucus in a classroom, that is a superior kind of participation in the selection of a candidate for president. And I think that's an issue that can be discussed with some pros and cons on both sides, but I don't think it's just a matter of asking people, well, do you want fewer people at your caucuses? I mean, who's gonna say that? I don't think anybody answered that yes. Senator Roebling, and then we'll go on to the next group.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And because I was not aware of how other Senate districts set up their caucuses, I'm surprised to learn how centralized they are. In my area, which is a little more rural, although suburban, every town has their own caucus. And if they have townships next to them, they bring them in too. So Shakopee and the two adjoining townships were at, the Republicans were at the senior high, the Democrats were at the junior high, and over in Prior Lake it was the same thing in Jordan. Now, this is not a good thing if you're a candidate, and this has happened to me from time to time. When you want to get out and meet as many caucus goers as possible, you can't get to all your caucuses. In fact, my township is a pretty good-sized township. We have our very own caucus, and you know, we had 70 people there, which was about six times more than we had the last time. So I mean, it was energizing, but we didn't have the same logistical problems because we break them up, and I kind of think caucuses should be treated as neighborhood events more whenever possible, or community events. A lot of people don't typically think of themselves as a Senate district, and since there is more happening here than picking a Senate candidate, I just think that could solve a lot of the problems, just organizing it so that you have four or five sites within a Senate district based on the communities that are within that district. And typically there's always plenty of facilities that you can access for events like that. And we did have some problems. I won't say that we didn't, and I know the Democrats in our area had some problems too. And we did have some people who went to their precincts, and they said they were from Shakopee, for example. I stopped at the Shakopee one, and someone had been driving around all night looking for the Shakopee caucus because they went to the fire station first, where they always vote, and nobody was there, and there was nobody to ask. And so then they went home, and they were typing on the Internet trying to find the site and finally came to the right spot. But it is confusing because it is set up differently than our typical elections. But I still like the idea of getting the neighborhood together and seeing actual faces. And no offense to the Independence Party, but human contact is really important to me. And I get really energized when I get out and get to visit and talk to other people. And I think a lot of people appreciate having that human contact. And I like to continue to encourage it.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Madam Chair, well, the next panel comes up. Maybe I could just
like to... Yes, if we could invite, let's see, Michelle Cornea and Joel Bergstrom and Marge Hoffa, the 3rd Congressional District Chair. And I welcome your testimony, and we are going to try and not have this hearing go as long as the caucuses did, but we do want to hear your unique experiences, and perhaps if there is something that is really the same, or if you could just speak to what is unique about the experiences that that you all had, but certainly answering Senator Betzel's question about whether you see for the future in Minnesota presidential politics, if it would be best for us to have a presidential primary. So if we can begin with you, if you will. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record, describe your district, and then what you'd like to add to the conversation tonight.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Michelle Cornier. I'm the Senate District Chair for Senate District 54. Senator Marty is our senator. Bev Scalzi and Mindy Greiling are our representatives. We cover Gem Lake, Lauderdale, Little Canada, Roseville, Shoreview, St. Anthony, and Badness Heights. We held our precinct caucuses at Roseville Area High School, which we've done for several years. The Republican caucuses were held at various locations, and they were not at the high school. In past years, they have been co-located at the high school. Just like everybody else, we had far more turnout than we anticipated. Our previous high had been 1,200. We had over 4,200 people participate in our precinct caucuses. Also, like many others, we did not have the exclusive use of the school or the parking lot. We were able to get everybody in. We did not have general registration. They were to register at their precincts in the rooms that the precincts were assigned. The biggest thing that we found, and I would reiterate, is people don't know what their precincts are. If they knew where their polling places were, however, if somehow the caucuses or the caucuses could be tied into the location of polling places or preference given to having caucuses at polling locations, that might be something that could be considered. We also did a lot of planning, ran a lot of copies, did that kind of stuff. I don't think I really have a whole lot of difference. I will reiterate that the vast majority of them were patient and gracious. And for the amount of frustration there must have been, just the sheer numbers of people in half a high school, I was impressed with that. I was impressed by the lack of complaints and the lack of complaints I've received since.
Almost the same as if it had been a natural disaster.
Yeah.
Right?
Almost.
Same kind of attitude. Or a big snowstorm.
Yep. I would say that as far as the role of government in facilitating civic involvement and political participation is different than facilitating other private organizations, because that is where it starts, and that is civic involvement, and that is how people select their government. And I think that they expected that there would be facilitation of the caucus system. They don't understand the difference that caucuses are privately run. They don't expect that. And many people in our precincts expected that they were going to be participating in an election and then leaving. My recommendation would be a hybrid system of a primary followed by caucuses. The caucuses would be binding, and they're how the parties would select their candidates. But this would give everybody an opportunity to be heard and encourage civic participation. And I would also encourage that the polling places be given precedence for caucus locations, because they're single precinct and people know where they are.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bergstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Joel Bergstrom. I'm the chair of the Senate District 60 DFL, which loosely defined as Southwest Minneapolis. We are exceptionally represented by Senator Scott Dibble, Representative Frank Hornstein, and Speaker Margaret Anderson Kelleher. I think we are an example of how the caucus system can work with planning. We annually have the highest turnout in the entire state, and this year is no exception. We had 13,626 attendees. 18 of those voted for Republicans, so the Secretary of State count is 13,608, but for the record. We have 26 precincts. We had those 26 precinct caucuses in 21 different locations. No more than two were in any one building. And we've been doing this for a long time. In 2004, we had over 5,000 attendees. 2006, we had somewhere in the neighborhood of 4,000 attendees. So we've planned for the turnout that these other districts have for a long time, and I think with planning it shows that it can work well. Again, we're a very urban area, but no residence in our entire district was more than 2 miles from its location. The vast majority of them were, 90% were within 1 mile. So we didn't have the traffic concerns that some others did. We didn't have the parking concerns. And with the exception of two locations, everybody voted before 8 o'clock, and the other two locations, the people who were in line still at 8 o'clock, were all allowed to vote. We didn't have the same issues of, you know, hearing stories of people not being able to get there because of traffic or anything. Again, We've been planning for this for a long time because we've had highest turnout in the state, but it shows, I think, that it can work with the right logistical planning. Some other folks have commented on the need for additional volunteers. You know, as turnout goes up, these volunteers come out of the woodwork. We find them through the caucus system. I think that both parties would agree that the data that we gathered on February 5th is probably incalculable in value in terms of to the state parties and their databases. The costs are borne by the local units. In ours, our costs for, you know, we did have 21 locations, so you do have some rental charges. The vast majority of them were at schools, some sanctuaries, and a couple park houses. So we did pay some fees, but our costs, including copy costs, were under $2,000, which we easily raised from our 13,000 attendees. And I think that we had a couple of questions earlier, I think Senator Betzel or Senator Rest. We did not have any I don't know of any challenges regarding people voting in the wrong place. I know of no instances of people voting multiple times. You only got a ballot when you registered, and that was very carefully managed. We did not run out of ballots. So, and again, we only had two locations where there were people still waiting to vote after 8 p.m., and that's with over 13,000 people voting. I would urge the committee to take its time in considering Senator Larson's motion. Bill, I don't see any reason to act on it this year. I think there's been talk of looking at other states, really examining this procedure. I'm a believer in the caucus system. Perhaps it needs tweaks, but I think we are an example that it can be done well. And the value of the civic participation can't be calculated. I have received three complaints from folks who either had trouble or didn't like the way their caucus was run, et cetera. And I think we all know, and I'm sure you all know with your aides, that people who want to be heard in their complaints will be heard. And those complaints, you know, were basically they didn't like the location or the convener, et cetera. But three complaints out of 13,000-plus attendees, I think, is pretty remarkable.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Senator Betzel.
Yeah, I do have a question, and this is just partially my own ignorance. I know that we use a lot of churches for polling places. Do you use churches for caucus locations, too, or do you have them all in public buildings, or what were the facilities that you used for your caucuses?
We knew attendance was going to be even higher this year, so we looked at the largest locations possible. A few of those are church sanctuaries, which we pay to use, like you would as any tenant or renter of the building. Community groups do the same thing. And some of them were the actual polling locations, just frankly because sanctuaries are the largest spaces sometimes. Another note, we did have some locations that we changed this year. Of our 26, I think eight of them changed locations because we were a little concerned about additional attendance. We got the word out about that. The campaigns help with that. It's on the Secretary of State's website. The state parties have the information. And then we also posted notices at the prior location so people would know to go to the new one. But I haven't heard any complaints about people not being able to find their locations.
Well, Mr. Bergstrom, I think you had an extraordinarily different experience than the rest of us, and I think even though I thought our Senate District Convention was energizing, even with the good offices of Mr. Fonest, it was chaotic. I ran into people over and over again who did not know where to go, that did not know what their precinct was, that were angry, even though they would calm down after they had voted, to come out and say, where do I vote for my Senate candidate? When are we going to talk? How come we didn't talk about our Senate candidate? Emails that I got that said, and maybe the three that complained in your district also complained to me, but people who were saying that they voted and they went back and then they had a question and they went and got in line to ask the question because there was no discussion of anything, and the first thing that happened to them is they were offered another ballot, they didn't take it, but there was no screening as to whether they could have another ballot. So you know, it sounds like a perfect world that you guys had, but that's not the kind of experience that people shared with us, and they didn't identify Senate districts, but identify to us with regard to their own personal experience, and they really didn't like. I mean, okay, yours didn't have to park, but people did not like having to walk 8 blocks or half a mile on a cold winter night, and many of them at our location, God forbid we should have had a fire, because the parking lot at Sandberg Middle School was filled with illegal parking. They all parked in the fire lanes. It was not a safe experience. We'll go on. I'll come back, if you will, but we'll go on to Ms. Hoffa.
Yeah. Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Marge Hoffa. I'm the chair of the 3rd Congressional District.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My experience is nothing like Joel Bergstrom's. I actually live in Norv Gurness's district, Senate District 42, and he did an exceptional job. I will say, however, that listening to the other Senate districts in the 3rd Congressional District, it was more like you described, chaos, a lot of traffic, confusion, people complaining that they couldn't get in the building, they couldn't find a place to park, particularly people that were elderly, had real issues, couples with small children, that was another issue. There just weren't, the facilities just didn't hold up. I heard from people in Bloomington.
How many of your Senate districts provided child care for people that
I'm not aware of any. I did enlist my two teenage girls to help in our district, but they didn't do much in the way of child care more than they did direct traffic, because it was crazy. But everybody had to pitch in. But I would say it was more like what you were discussing earlier with, it was just kind of crazy all over. I mean, traffic jams in Bloomington, in Maple Grove, in every Senate district, 43 in the northern part of Minnetonka, all around the schools. It was crazy. And people were frustrated. And I also talked to one of the city clerks in Minnetonka. She said they were coming to City Hall to vote. They were going to their precincts to vote. I mean, all the things that we've heard earlier, it was just like that everywhere in the 3rd Congressional District, in every Senate district. And I Senator Betzold had said, well, what was our experience? I think that's pretty typical of the experience. And as far as recommendations that I've been receiving, it's more along the lines of we should have a presidential primary and still continue the caucus system, because the caucus system is a great system for a lot of things. And we want the participation of everyday citizens, but we also don't want to disenfranchise people. And that's the word I heard from a lot of people, was we feel like we were disenfranchised because we don't have that hour and a half where we can go and vote. And we want our voices heard. Whether that's going to be different in 4 years or 8 years or 12 years, I think Senator Larson's bill has a lot of merit, and it's something that should be looked at carefully, as Joel Bergstrom said, but it's certainly something that has done well in other states where you have the presidential primary and a caucus system that coexist.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Hoffer. Mr. Bergstrom, I'll let you respond to my comments.
No, you know, our district, we did have some hiccups here and there. There were long lines. People waited outside.
Well, I'm think glad my point, to hear now that you're not perfect. I was just beginning to wonder here.
What I'm saying is that I think we show that it is possible to manage these crowds with some forward thinking and some planning. Now, we've had these crowds for a while, so it's people are used to having locations within their precinct. There is a concern about if you change locations, people will have trouble finding them. I don't know how many hits the Secretary of State's website got that day, but I'm sure it was tens of thousands in the weeks leading up to. People will, you know, democracy takes some interaction. And while voting on November 4th is something that's guaranteed by our Constitution, the choosing of the candidates that get on that ballot is not done in the same way. So I think the parties have to be consulted, and you're doing that, although none of us speaks on behalf of the state party, the state DFL party. I think we all show that there's certainly a varying opinion. But I think the big thing is when folks want to engage in the caucus process and the primary process and choosing the president, it takes some energy to do so, and it takes a commitment to do so, just like voting on Election Day does. And we want to make sure that those folks get a chance to do that, but we also want to get the engaged citizen. We, I think, would love to be Iowa, where, you know, you dream about that every person in every barbershop knows about every candidate and has really weighed their decision. We're not going to get to that place anytime soon, but we do, through the caucus system, I think, do get people who are a little more engaged. I don't know that going to a presidential primary addresses any of the concerns regarding Senate candidates, questions about the process, or the parking and fire lane concerns. You still need the logistical issues of figuring out multiple locations and informing the public of where their caucus location is.
Okay, thank you very much. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Bergstrom, just curious how many of the 13,000 attendees, what percentage stayed, to the degree that you can estimate that? I know that's probably a difficult and maybe a rough estimate, but I'd be interested to know how many stayed, how many voted and left, and what's your experience been with that in the past as compared to this year?
Well, I think 2004 we had the similar process where it was the ballot that you could take and then leave was the binding for the Democratic selection process. And I think then, as in now, a good portion of people, as they're told by the campaigns, show up, vote, and then leave.
No.
I would say it's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% plus. The room where I was at, my precinct had 730 attendees. We were in a gym. We had well over 300 chairs set up, plus standing room, and it was packed. People stayed past their voting time. They stayed to wait. Because they wanted to hear the results of their precinct. They wanted to express their opinion regarding becoming a delegate. So I can't say for sure, but that's probably typical. Whatever the room could hold. And most of our rooms were 300-plus capacity.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your being here with us this evening.
Thank you.
Next, I'm going to skip around a little bit, Mr. Stafford. I'd like to invite Barrett Johannesson and Mary Jean Turenia Anderson to join us. And the two of you are not party officers. You are just participants. Is that
correct?
Yes.
Yes.
So we'll hear from you, and then we'll go and ask Mr. Stafford and Ms. Pearson and the Secretary of State to be the next panel. But if you would share with us your experiences and what your recommendation would be in terms of how Minnesota's political parties organize themselves. Ms. Anderson, we'll start with you.
Madam Chair, committee members, thanks for the chance to share with you my experience this last Tuesday.
And you do need to identify yourself for the record.
Yes. My name is Mary Jean Turenia Anderson. I live in Roseville, and I reside in District 54. I have some notes here, but I don't have my glasses, so I'm just going to speak to you more from the heart, I think, than anything. I've lived in Minnesota all my life. I've voted in all the elections, certainly all the presidential elections. I was struck by two things at the caucus. One was a very gratifying sense that there was a huge turnout, that people really wanted to be engaged. They really wanted to participate, and that was a positive. I was able to navigate my way across a freeway three or four blocks to the building. I waited outside for probably 20 minutes in below zero wind chill temperatures, got in, went up three flights of stairs after locating the room where my precinct caucus occurred, and I got in. I was given a ballot. I voted. I stayed and became a delegate that night. What I'm here tonight about is really the second item, and that is that there were barriers. There are enormous barriers to participation. And interestingly, I haven't heard anyone tonight speak directly to what those barriers are and who is facing those barriers. First of all, I've already mentioned all the logistical barriers, but I'll tell you a story. I have a mother who's 93 years old, and she'll be 94 in May. She follows all of the presidential campaigns religiously. She's glued to CNN and just about any other news program you can imagine. She has, over the last 10, 15 years, had to vote by absentee ballot because she cannot attend a caucus. She cannot attend. You go to her polling place. She always votes in presidential elections. She has strong opinions this year in particular about who should be our next president. She wanted to cast her vote at a caucus, and we talked a bit about it, and I explained to her where it would be, when it would be, and she knew that there was no way that she could possibly get there. And it's more than transportation. She has developed heart failure. She has severe osteoporosis. She has arthritis. It is physically impossible for her to appear, and so she could not cast that vote. I would support a presidential primary, absolutely, if for no other reason than that it would give a person an opportunity to, hopefully, to cast an absentee ballot. I suspect, and probably in your families and your acquaintanceships, you know of people who cannot go out to a caucus. They can't physically get there. And just in closing, I was reading an article in the newspaper the other day referring to the quote that the world is run by those who show up. Mm-hmm. Well, that might be true. The world probably is run by those who show up. But that does not make it morally right. And I think those are my only comments. I'm talking about inclusivity.
Sure. Thank you very much, Ms. Anderson. Interestingly enough, I don't know what party you chose, but to go to, but on the among the Democrats, your mother could have sent in a letter and been elected a delegate, but she would not have been allowed to vote because there was no absentee voting. So there's an irony there in terms of encouraging people to participate. But thank you very much,
Madam Chair.
Mr. Johannesson.
Madam Chair, just an observation on the absentee ballot. As I mentioned earlier, how Governor Romney dropped off or suspended his campaign just 2 days after our primary. Just the week before, former Mayor Giuliani and former Senator Edwards suspended their campaign. So, unfortunately, you know, if people were supporting them and voted absentee, you know, what do they do if they've already voted, and then the candidate of their choice, because it's so fluid during that particular time period, at least it was this year. So I don't know that absentee ballot solves everything, though. So.
Right.
But they've heard their story. They've had their voice and their choice heard.
Yeah. Right. Mr. Johannesson.
Madam Chair and the committee, thank you for inviting me to be here to testify today. My name is Barrett Johannesson.
Thank you.
I was a participant in the Minnesota DFL caucuses on Super Tuesday in Minneapolis Ward 6, Precinct 2. While there, I included my name as a delegate living in Senate District 61. Like thousands of other civic-minded Minnesotans, my goal was to cast a presidential preference ballot, and like them, I was honored to cast a ballot for my preferred candidate. Clearly, Minnesota's legacy of high voter turnout remains strong, and our voting and election laws have empowered the people of this great state. However, I witnessed a series of problems at my caucus that I feel are necessary to share with you today in the hopes for meaningful, equitable, and accountable caucus reform. Here is what I saw. Despite training and experience, our able convener was caught between two separate and simultaneous processes: the balloting and the caucus business agenda, processes that I believe should be separated even further. Logistical issues ranged from voters clamoring between the convener and his audience, to a room ill-equipped to the deaf, blind, and hard of hearing, to an unofficial and wide-open cardboard ballot box, to flimsy and unofficial squares of paper that served as ballots, and to an overcapacity room that may have violated fire codes. Those who sought to cast ballots, technically caucus-goers, streamed in from the moment the door opened until the time that the caucus closed, unintentionally interrupting the long and tedious caucus explanation process. A crowded room of people attempted to do 2 years' worth of party business without an agenda, without a script, and without comprehensive rules to govern the process. For instance, there was no mention or motion for a walking sub-caucus, as that occasion is apparently deemed optional. Caucus goers, including myself, were confused about how the caucus affected our opportunity to support a candidate for U.S. Senate or elections for any other office besides president. Only campaign operatives were available to answer caucus goers' questions about the process when those operatives could be located at all. Many people who came to support a U.S. Senate candidate found no ballot with their candidate's name on it and exited before the delegate selection process was completed. In the case of the caucus on Super Tuesday, delegates were selected based on their willingness to provide contact information and exhibit vital signs. Roughly 100 people lined up single file to write their names and addresses one at a time in an unofficial spiral notebook. Like that notebook, delegates elected at the precinct level are accountable to no one but themselves, having been elected as strangers by strangers with no paper trail and with no proof of residency or eligibility. As opposed to a primary, a 90-minute or 120-minute caucus means disenfranchisement for people working the late shift, disenfranchisement for those traveling outside of their precinct, disenfranchisement for those with child care concerns, and disenfranchisement for those who are confined at home because of health concerns or their status as senior citizens. To my knowledge, the caucus process lacks even the opportunity that comes with a primary system. For instance, there was no apparatus for voters to cast an early ballot, an absentee ballot, to vote by mail, or to vote in any other way than by being available during one 90-minute period on a Tuesday night. The result was a snarled state transportation system as voters were trapped in a Super Tuesday traffic jam that partially coincided with rush hour. Anecdotal evidence suggests that caucus locations were ill-equipped to provide enough parking space to those who showed up. To put it quite simply, the caucus system collapsed because many people wanted to participate, but the caucus itself limited them. I believe that the process of deciding our leadership and its direction should be as easy, accessible, and transparent as possible. As record-breaking turnout indicates, thousands of us braved the cold and the cynicism to participate in our democracy. We should be rewarded with a process that encourages even more Minnesotans to make their voices not simply heard at the polls, but to have their intent register officially and unequivocally. I urge the legislature to abolish the caucus and expedite a move toward a primary system, preferably incorporating early voting, absentee voting, and perhaps instant runoff voting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johannesson. Very succinctly put, are there questions or comments? Senator Betzel.
Senator, just as a comment, I don't know that legally we could abolish the caucuses. I mean, if that's a party's decision. If they choose to have them, they can have them. I think it would take the legislature to authorize an election, right. But the caucuses can conduct whatever business. Just as we saw this year when we had a state law saying that the caucuses are going to be March 4th, and the party said, well, we don't care. We're going to have them on February 5th. And they did it. So.
But I think that the argument or the point would still come back up of the government protection for the caucus sure. was still there, and there would be government protection, if that's the right word to use, if for a presidential primary, in terms of if a party decided to participate, that would be people would be given time off from work to vote and so on to protect the parties in that way, in the same way that local governments can't meet after 6 o'clock. That kind of I guess Mr. Carey would call it interference with the private club, Senator Roebling, that you belong to. And I guess that he thinks we all belong to. But I think there would still be some kind of thing like that. Thank you very much. We appreciate your taking the time, and glad to hear that there are my mother has passed away, but my mother was very, very similar in terms of her participation in our political party, and even after she was 80, she was still a delegate to the state convention and was quite a rabble-rouser, so... Our mothers probably would have enjoyed one another's company. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask Mr. Stafford and Professor Pearson and Secretary of State if you'd come forward together. I'm sure having different viewpoints and different things to say to us, but it's just easier if you're together. Mr. Stafford, I think we'll start with you, if you will. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record, and share your perspective with us.
Chair Rest, Senators, thank you for this opportunity to testify before your committee about Minnesota precinct caucuses in a possible presidential primary. My name is Rick Stafford. I have been a 35-plus-year DFL party activist who served as the DFL's party state chair in the early 90s during the GROW Commission recommendations, and currently serve as one of the two Minnesota Democratic National Committee members. I want to stress that I am here today as an interested DFLer and do not voice this as an official representative of the DFL party.
Indeed.
I have a long history within the DFL with regards to the formulation and implementation of our party's multi-tiered caucus system. I was the main proponent of the DFL non-binding presidential preference ballot in 1988, and I was the author of the binding presidential preference ballot in the DFL beginning at the 2000 precinct caucuses. In 2007, I worked along with Senator Larson in an attempt to secure establishing a presidential primary in 2008 or an earlier precinct caucus date. After the legislature failed to approve a primary or move the caucus date to an earlier February timeline, I was the author and main proponent within the DFL party's executive committee to move our precinct caucuses to February 5th. And that motion at that time invited the Republicans and the Greens and the Independents Party to join us. And our state chair, Brian Melendez, reached out to Chair Kerry, and he joined us. Not in my wildest dreams did I ever think when moving our caucus date to Super Duper Tuesday, would the turnout be on the DFL side of such record-setting proportions. It was my best hope scenario that about 100,000 Minnesotans would caucus DFL. Kudos go out in droves to the undeterred Minnesotans who braved weather that kept Como Zoo polar bears inside. But also kudos go to the many, many local DFL volunteers as party leaders that organized these precinct caucuses, even with all their glitches. One of the things that we learned is that these individuals wanted a voice in selecting the Democratic Party's presidential nominee. They spoke to us DFL party leaders in many ways. Even those that were deterred and went home spoke to us that night and afterwards, and we should listen. I'm not one of those that let's get rid of the precinct caucuses camp. I'm in what I call the hybrid camp. And I humbly ask that you, as the public elected stewards of Minnesota's most sacred voting rights, to give serious consideration to a hybrid concept. My hybrid is this. In presidential years, the state of Minnesota holds a binding presidential primary on the first Tuesday in February with abbreviated voting hours from 7 to 7. Then, starting at 7:30 p.m., each major political party would begin their precinct caucuses to conduct their usual caucus business, including the first step process for considering party endorsement of various level elective public office and discussing and adopting public policy issues. In non-presidential years, the major political parties would hold their caucuses just like they have done. Why have I, you might ask the question, why have I turned from a precinct caucus purist to a presidential year botanist? I believe that the nature of the presidential nominating process has greatly changed over the last 20 years. In addition, in Minnesota, Democratic voters only get one bite at the apple in selecting our presidential nominee before a general election. While for all other elective offices that Minnesota voters decide, they get two bites at that apple. The endorsement caucus process, as well as the September party primary. Unfortunately, using only the caucus system to determine the one-bite presidential nominee has limited voter participation and diversity on several fronts. The current system realistically disenfranchises a large segment of elderly voters, many working men and women, the disabled, and it has a non-metropolitan disadvantage in its participation. I strongly believe that if any presidential primary bill is enacted, it must be a binding primary, and it must contain a record of party ballot request that, like that was used in 1992. Last year's bill, introduced by Senator Larson, eliminated this provision because legislators were reacting to a small sample of voters who were upset at finding out that the party ballot request was recorded. I think that the almost 300,000 Minnesota citizens who came out on a cold winter night to brave finding a parking spot and then standing in line for long hours to put their names on a registration roll of a specific partisan party has effectively neutralized that opposition. Plus, let us remember that this is a process where a political party selects their nominee. I know we can't cover every nuance today. As I jokingly say, within the DFL party, it would normally take us 20-plus hearings or meetings over a two-year period to come to some final resolution. So I have a very simple recommendation on how your colleagues might proceed if serious about a presidential primary and slight revamping of the precinct caucus statutory requirements. It is strike while the iron is hot. Enact a simple but clean binding presidential primary that provides party ballot request record. Revise the Minnesota Precinct Caucus statutory language to give the Secretary of State the authority to set the date and time of political party caucuses after consultation with all major political parties. This will give the major political parties 3 years for their internal party structure to discuss and fine-tune any new arrangement that will protect the retail, neighbor-to-neighbor strengths of precinct caucuses. In turn, the legislature will have, at a minimum, of two sessions to make corrections to statutory law and making a blend of a presidential primary alongside of precinct caucuses work successfully for the party activists, but also for the Minnesota citizens as a whole who spoke on caucus night last week. I suggest that Minnesotans do not really care what party elders or leaders are pleased by or disappointed in. I suggest that Minnesotans are more about what will advance majority interests at the same time cherishedly protecting minority rights and viewpoints. You have a great opportunity for greater citizen participation while still allowing the political parties to maintain control of their larger endorsing processes. Don't let that opportunity slip by you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stafford. Ms. Pearson, Professor Pearson.
Thank you.
And I will, we invited Professor Pearson to come this evening following the appearance in the Star Tribune of the op-ed that she wrote that is in your packet. Professor Pearson.
Thank you, Chairwoman Rest, and thank you, committee members, for considering this issue so seriously. I'm a political science professor at the University of Minnesota. In my classes, I tell my students that the rules of the game matter. This is evident in Minnesota's caucus system, whose virtues are overshadowed by its cost. In comparison to primaries, caucuses depress voter participation and raise questions about the integrity of the electoral process, which strike at the heart of democratic legitimacy. A caucus system ensures that relatively few citizens will participate in the electoral process because of the barriers it imposes to participation. Now, both parties have been touting record turnout, as has, frankly, everyone in this room tonight, and indeed, turnout has gone up. But I would argue that the participation of less than one-tenth of eligible voters in Minnesota in this record-breaking year is hardly something to brag about, especially in a state that consistently sets records and turnout in general elections. So let me be more specific and provide some evidence that turnout, in fact, would have been much greater in Minnesota last Tuesday had it been a primary system, contrary to some of the anecdotal evidence that people are providing. So, in November of 2004, Minnesota led the nation in turnout with 77% of the voting eligible population. Compare that to California, where 60% of the voting eligible population turned out that same day. Now, both California and Minnesota held elections last Tuesday. Turnout in Minnesota, less than 10%. Yet in California's primary, turnout Turnout was 35%. That's a gap of more than 25% in California's favor compared to a 17% point gap in Minnesota's favor in November of 2004. Michael McDonald, a political scientist at George Mason University, who's an expert in voter turnout and runs the United States Election Project, has calculated turnout from all states who participated on February 5th. The difference in turnout between caucus and primary states is striking. The combined turnout rate of February 5th primary states is 29%. The combined turnout of caucus states is 6.3%. So clearly, turnout would not be the same if Minnesota had a primary. So why are caucuses so disenfranchising? Well, a lot of this has already been said tonight, so I'll move quickly. The timing, of course. Voters can only caucus during a narrow window, excluding those who work, attend class, or have any number of other responsibilities. Caucuses, as also been discussed, caucuses impose physical and logistical barriers that don't occur when voting is stretched out over an all-day window during primaries. Long lines, limited parking on a cold night discourage potential voters, especially those physically not up to it, which would not happen in primaries. And then this point is particularly important for people to recognize in this room, and it's backed up by political science research. Caucuses are intimidating for people who are not politically active, who are most of the people in the state who are nonetheless equally effective by the policies elected officials enact. Not understanding that this year it was possible to go to a caucus and cast a presidential ballot without discussing policies with their neighbors, many people who vote regularly in general elections didn't caucus because they simply felt they didn't know how. So, again, the people in this room probably can't imagine that people wouldn't feel comfortable participating, but in a record turnout year, when you still have less than one-tenth of the people participating, I think that's important to remember. So the result, also backed up by political science research, is that caucuses typically bring out people who are the most active in politics, whose views are not necessarily representative of party identifiers across the state, or even of people who would participate in primaries. Turnout in caucuses is correlated with partisan and ideological passion, or to put another way, extremism, and political science studies show over and over again that strong partisans and ideologues are more likely to participate than typical voters, and that is correlated with the high costs of voting. General elections are the most representative, primaries next, and then caucuses. And of course, as has been noted many times, caucuses are governed by parties, not election laws, and that caused a lot of problems this year. Precincts ran out of ballots, people were voting on post-it notes, someone could have easily stuffed the ballot boxes. Just because party officials don't know that people did does not mean that it didn't or couldn't happen. Voters were confused, entering precinct caucuses where signs were only in favor of one candidate, and this calls into question the neutrality of election administration, something that would not be a problem with primaries. As has also been suggested, I want to refute something else that's been suggested, that there is no evidence that Minnesota's caucuses allow underfunded presidential candidates to get their message out. That may be the case in Iowa, but it's not because Iowa is a caucus state. It's because Iowa is first and Iowa is small. New Hampshire residents have the same types of opportunities to meet with underfunded candidates because it's small and it's a primary state and it's second. Again, the selection of candidates for state and federal office has been mentioned, poses perhaps even greater problems because there's no discussion or actual voting for these candidates, and I recognize that this is a party matter, but if they are indicating that they will abide by a party endorsement, yet no meaningful votes are cast in caucuses, that is also a problem. Party leaders defend Minnesota's caucus system because it allows people to participate in a meaningful way, but it certainly does not maximize voter participation. And if that's one of the most important values in an electoral system, maximizing participation, I would support Senator Larson's bill that would do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor. Last but certainly not least, our Secretary of State, Secretary Ritchie, I would be interested in hearing from you the experience your office had in receiving the information from the various Senate districts across the state in reporting the balloting, and just under what rules or what understanding with the political parties did you receive that information? We've heard in other states, I don't know if it was a primary or a caucusing, but I don't know if, and I can't remember if it was Arizona or New Mexico, that they still don't know what the voting was, even, or what the results were, final results were, even a week later. So I wonder if you'd comment. You certainly can comment on your views on a presidential primary, but I think you, of all the others here tonight, played a unique role, your office did, in the caucuses this year, and if you would talk to us about that, I appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Ritchie. I serve the state as Secretary of State, and thank you for this opportunity, and I want to get right to your question. Our office respects that this is a party nomination process. This is not an election, and we do not think of it as an election. But statutorily, we have two very important responsibilities. One, getting the word out. So our precinct caucus finder was one of the ways that we did that, very effective. About 180,000 people used it, 90,000 on election day, 25,000 people used it in line during the caucuses to make sure they were in the right line. So But the other responsibility is reporting the results of governor and presidential straw polls. So this year, of course, no governor, so presidential was the important one. The first meetings with the parties, which were really centered around the caucus locating tool, was, I think, in October, November of last year, extremely good, sophisticated sort of sharing of information and very good cooperation. All of the parties who chose to do caucuses, so that's five of the six, provided their information on time, information got in, and we made an arrangement for the reporting of the results that I think was a very effective system. Essentially, the parties had individual reporters, let's say Republican and Democrat, just for the to be quick here, about 4,000 precincts. Both of them had about 120 captains. The precincts called to those captains. It was slightly different and different names and parties. And those 120 so people entered the data by precinct into our caucus finder. It was web-based. And then you could see the results of that immediately. The first ones were at 8 o'clock.
It was all done electronically.
I believe they were phoned in. I was not in the field. I was actually in the computer room. I believe they were phoned in to the captains, and the captains entered them into our web page. I believe that was correct.
So the last step was electronic,
correct.
Rather than reporting to your office
correctly,
verbally.
These are the parties' nominating process and not elections, and we leave it to them. Very interestingly, right at 8 o'clock, just a couple minutes after we got the first results. Actually, the first results hit almost simultaneously. Rock and the counties in the southwest corner and Lake and Cook in the northeast corner hit almost immediately, and then throughout the evening. And the two major parties stayed relatively close in terms of reporting. That was very interesting to me because, it was easy to see that there was going to be huge turnout, but it was hard to see exactly how big. Another interesting thing is that the Democratic Party results essentially never changed at all the entire night. The Republican Party results did change some over the course of the evening, not a lot, but some. But we were able to monitor those really moment by moment as people entered the results. We had hoped that the parties would enter actual caucus attendees and their votes. That part of it didn't work, so we used the ballots reported as a surrogate number for caucus attendees. And late at night when we quit, about 2 in the morning, we had 80% in on the Democratic side, 202,000, I think, and we had about that in on the Republican side, 56,000. I think final was 63. Republicans are very close to 100% in, 63,000, almost 63,000. Democrats probably will come in at 215, 218. There's still some things out there. But the process
Don't have all of the votes, quote, counted or reported?
One county? Yeah. So I think the Republicans are 0.3% shy of having all precincts reported, and I think the Democrats are 1% or so shy of having all precincts reported. So we are very close.
And do you expect them to report, or is the system just overwhelm the reporters?
Well, my only experience.
It's a good number, but it's not 100%.
I don't know because it's the party's responsibility, but my impression from the 06 straw poll is that eventually they do get the final numbers in. And I did see 1 hour that the Republican Party was at 100%. So, you know, this is kind of, you know, it's something that we pursue a little bit each day. But essentially our job was done. We got the word out with the help of the media, and the caucus finder held up, the location finder, and the reporting tool adequately reported for the purposes of the Democratic Party, which is binding, and for the Republican Party, they seem very happy with it, and we will wait and look forward to the posting of the results from the Independence Party. The Constitution Party also posted at 8 o'clock that night, although they had caucused on the Saturday before. They sort of gave us a little slack because we weren't quite ready, and then the Green Party will caucus in a month. My sense is that our staff did a really good job of fulfilling our two responsibilities, largely because we had excellent cooperation from the parties, and the media were tremendous in their picking up the publicity part. The day following Super Tuesday, I flew out to our National Association of Secretaries of State meeting. There were about 40 other secretaries of state, everybody reeling from super big turnout everywhere in the country. People were very cognizant of how big ours were. Most people experienced double. And, of course, our own Republican Party experienced double. But nobody really experienced something like we did with four times growth. Some states were able to provide some very detailed information. For example, Tennessee knew that there were four times more young adults voting this time than in 04. So some people had more sophisticated demographic statistics, but we certainly had the largest growth. We spent quite a bit of time at that meeting doing two things that I think are relevant for tonight's discussion. One of them is that we met with representatives of the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee, who are both in deep conversations about a new national overall framework for primaries. Republican Party Rules Committee will gather in New Mexico, I think, April 1 and 2 for 2 days to debate a new form of national structure. And they have to do it now because it must be approved at their convention, which, of course, is here. If they don't do it here, they have to wait another 4 years. Something is brewing there. There will probably be something coming. And then the Democrats have basically said, we will tell you what we think about it, and if we like it enough, we will do roughly the same. And Dr. Howard Dean, the chair of the Democratic National Committee, said this to us in a meeting. So April 1st and 2nd, there'll be a big battle in the Republican Rules Committee. The nominee will, of course, have a lot of say in this, but in September in St. Paul, likely the Republican Party will set some new kind of framework at a national level for how the party will function, and then the Democrats are likely, through their executive committee, to do the same. So I've asked to be kept informed of that, and I'm actually on the committee directly working with that, so I can keep you informed to the best of my ability on that. The second is that states shared information on what they did. Maine, for example, uses absentee ballots in the caucus system. You mentioned New Mexico. New Mexico uses a form of provisional balloting, which is impossible, and it has moved the secretary there to try to adopt to propose the adoption of same-day registration, because I explained to her how this solves the problem, and today I sent her our background information. Illinois asked for our information, but New Mexico's a mess. It's in problem. Washington State, one of the interesting hybrids, and the Secretary of State of Washington, very, very knowledgeable kind of person. All of them were very, very clear that they do not consider these elections, these are party nomination processes, and they are glad to be helpful. Everybody has had some form of a court order, court ruling, judge's opinion that has put in perspective. Washington might, I may have this wrong because the conversation was quite rich, but I think Washington, one of the parties, blends. The party's own decision is to blend the outcome of the primary vote and the caucus. So there are different things that people do. it was clear to me that other states have thought about who's excluded, and they've done more than we have. Maine having absentee ballot example. New Mexico did work hard to get their soldiers and others overseas to participate. Obviously, they had other problems, but I thought that was good. You know, our office is ready to serve the parties and the citizens in any way that people want. Our local election officials know how to run primaries. You know, I mean, we are professionals all the way down. So if there's a decision to move forward, I think people will be quite professional and quite sophisticated in how we do it. But the bottom line will remain for local officials in particular, but also for our office, is, of course, the cost. And I have to say that Senator Larson has also put forward other proposals who are very much in the realm of cost savings. And we haven't had time to do the hard numbers crunching, but for example, some of the automatic voter registration proposal would save nearly the cost that's been estimated. So the money part of this needs to be looked at very carefully from the terms of real cost, because, you know, we're kind of loose on this. And then what are cost savings that could come from other ways or other reforms potentially that might bring this into the kind of fiscal balance that would be needed? We just haven't had time, you know, to think it through carefully. We would look forward to working with staff and with others on this. But at the end of the day, whatever the parties would like and whatever the legislators would like, we feel very prepared to handle it. And we also think that there are ways to address in a responsible way the fiscal parts of this proposal and other proposals that might come forward. Thank you again for this opportunity.
It's really interesting information. It will be further interesting then to really pay attention to the Republican National Committee or whoever it is. It's meeting April 1st and 2nd, and a bit ironic if the changes that they propose will occasion a need for changes in state statutes.
Madam Chair, you're right. And I've been asked to meet with a member of the Republican National Committee Rules Committee from Minnesota, but I don't have the name yet. But that might be an interesting person to ask to testify.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Well, think about that. Are there questions for Mr. Stafford or Professor Pearson? The Secretary at this point? Okay, thank you very much. Senator Larson, could you very briefly describe your bill, and then we will bring this hearing to a close. And is Deborah Scogin here? If you would like to join Senator Larson, I don't think you'll mind. Members do have the presidential primary summary in front of them, and Senator Larson, we're going to try and finish this up in the next 7-8 minutes. Is that okay with you?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's been a very long day for many of us.
Yeah, it's been a very long day for all of us.
I didn't think it would go this long, but I think it's been a very engaging discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree fully, and I want to begin by thanking you for having this hearing. I think the most important part of the hearing has occurred, and that's hearing from people from across Minnesota that have different roles, from folks that were attendees on the precinct caucus day to the party chairs. And I think their attendance here tonight has made this a very successful hearing and been very helpful as we're trying to look to the future and how to move forward. Senate File 1527 was introduced a year ago, and when Representative Simon and I introduced the bill, it was essentially out of excitement for the upcoming presidential election and the prospect of having more people in Minnesota participate through a primary system was really attractive. And so as members would recall, we had the discussion in the subcommittee. We had we passed the bill from the full committee to Senator Betzold's committee, but of course it was the budgetary concerns that that got in our way, and legitimately so. The cost is not insignificant, and as I recall, the state government budget division also had a negative target, which got in our way as well. But nonetheless, it was the excitement about the prospect increased participation, having that increased participation occur in future presidential elections that was the impetus for introducing the bill. Never had I, or I don't know if anyone else could have predicted the kind of turnout that we had last Tuesday. What an incredible statement about people's willingness and desire to participate in our democratic process and the process to select candidates for president. I could summarize quickly the presidential primary bill that was in Senator Betzold's bill and has now been returned to this committee as essentially a hybrid bill or a hybrid system, if you will, that would institute a presidential primary in this case in the first Tuesday after the first Monday in February, which would have been that last Tuesday, lays out the procedures that are necessary for that. One thing that I would note, without going section to section because we're trying to conclude early or more quickly, is that the data in which the way in which voters received the ballots and the data that was derived from that primary in 1992, the last time we had a presidential primary in Minnesota, is different from what is in this proposal. As members would recall, data was provided through the Secretary of State's office. By the way that we signed in and signed affidavits, separate ballots were provided to voters, by which then we, the public, were able to know which primary, the DFL primary or the Republican primary, a voter participated in. This bill does not do that. This bill is far more like a general election that does not have that distinction about which primary, which side of the primary a voter votes in. That's one distinction. But the key discussion
does that
item.
Happen, Senator Larson, does that happen in any other state? I mean, we know states like South Carolina have their presidential primaries even on different dates for the parties. Is there any other that has a presidential primary ballot that is similar to a general election ballot?
Madam Chair, that's a great question, and I'm going to rely on Mr. Watson. I don't know if Mr. Watson has the answer to that as it relates to other states.
California, we hear from the audience.
We're hearing from somewhere that it's California. All right. Madam Chair, to conclude without going through the bill more thoroughly, this is where we arrived last year for consideration. We didn't quite make it, again, due to the fiscal constraints. Last Tuesday has provided a lot of information and a lot of experiences for us to consider as we craft a presidential primary bill moving forward. I have never been more resolved for us to pass this legislation. I think it is necessary that Minnesotans have the opportunity to vote in a presidential primary. And I want to get to the very heart of why I think it's most important that we provide this opportunity to Minnesotans. In the Senate District 63, which is part of the 3rd Congressional District that Chair Hoffa spoke about earlier, we had that incredible turnout that we had across Minnesota that turned essentially or almost to chaos. It was difficult for people to get to their rooms, for them to caucus. I know in many cases people caucused in the wrong rooms. In many cases they were on, the caucuses were on the second floor. In many cases, in a very large number of cases, folks did not have the ability to park within a reasonable area or distance of the building to get to their caucus. I maintain that our turnout was far higher last Tuesday than we were actually able to record. Our turnout was far higher because I've had many people that have called and emailed since that caucus last Tuesday who said they just simply gave up because they didn't feel like they could have the opportunity to wait in the line out in the cold or to wade through the confusion to have that opportunity to essentially vote. And that gets to the center of the problem, in my eyes, is that there seems to be a real desire for our parties to hold an election within the caucus system. And given the nature of us knowing the outcome of that event, we've moved more toward there being an election system within the caucus. Yet the parties aren't equipped to handle an election. And many different things that have been, many different points that have been made tonight, I won't make them again, make our election administration system in Minnesota one of the best in the country as it relates to absentee voting, as it relates to all of the protections that we have as it relates to accessibility, ballot security, and on and on and on. That's why I think if we are, and the parties desire to have, and move toward an election system, that we do it in the way that we as a legislature have determined to be lawful and reasonable to protect people's voting rights in Minnesota. And I think it will also be excellent for and great for our public for their interest in participation, and believe that we'll have growing participation in future elections. I would like to conclude, Madam Chair, by again thanking you for having the hearing and encouraging anyone who has those ideas, whether they were mentioned tonight or you have additional ideas about what a Minnesota presidential primary bill ought to look like. Please contact me, contact members for the public, contact members of the committee, so that we have an opportunity to consider those potential changes to this legislation as we recraft it and move forward to consider a presidential primary bill that can work for Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator Larson. Ms. Scogin, if you'd identify yourself, please, we'll be pleased to have your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deb Scogin. I'm the city clerk for the city of Fridley, which Senator Betzold does represent, and Senator Chadway as well. Having been involved in the political process, I was excited to see the interest and turnout of the caucuses. Due to the national media exposure and Super Tuesday, there was a lot of confusion. This year's caucuses generated an unprecedented number of phone calls to our staff asking, where do I go vote? What precinct am I in? People actually went to the polling places, and we had to let them know, you have to go to your caucus. It's really a poll. It's not a vote. It's not like another election day. But we spent most of our day fielding those calls. Not only did we do that, we had questions prior to that about absentee ballots. How do I get an absentee ballot? Well, I'm sorry, this isn't an election. You have to contact your party chair. Senate File 1527 proposes to conduct a non-binding presidential primary in February. As the election is non-binding, what is the public good in appropriating money from our taxpayers, especially in light of our other pressing needs? Cities have already had local government aid taken away from them. Now you're going to have us doing additional work, which means we have to set aside other work that we have. It's an unfunded mandate as far as the city is concerned. We have to remember is caucuses belong to the political parties, and it's a process to endorse their candidates. This year's caucuses, as the proposed primary, offers no meaningful information other than polling data. In addition, the outcome in February, is it truly reflective of the people that are voting in November? We all know there are people who are satisfied with the candidate who cross party lines to vote for somebody that may sway the outcome of the other candidate. Senate File 1527 requires an election be administered at the same as the state primary, which means election day registration. It means absentee ballot voting. Like I said, I have to set aside 6 weeks, 80% of my time, to administer this election in addition to having other staff. While the legislation proposes to appropriate no more than $480,000 for personnel costs, it is most likely not the amount that we need to reimburse cities and counties for their actual personnel costs incurred in running this election. City of Fridley held an election this past November. We had a charter amendment. The cost to the city with 13 precincts was $13,234. We had about a 17% voter turnout. Normally, our turnout is in the 80 percentiles. These costs don't include wages and personnel costs. These just cover the printing of the ballots, the supplies, the election judges. If we added personnel costs, it would add an additional $12,000 to the cost of the election. That would be $25,000. Keeping in mind there are over 800 cities, many cities larger than the city of Fridley. We have about 27,000 people in our city. The appropriation would only cover 40 cities similar to mine. Due to the way that I've heard the proposed state appropriation would be allocated, if there isn't enough money, it would be rebated, so we would not receive the full amount that the election cost us. In conclusion, I believe changes can be made to the current caucus process, which could ensure higher participation. I urge you to move with extreme caution in adopting legislation at this time without having further discussions among the political parties and election officials. Like the Secretary of State said, we are here to help the public, but I don't think it is government's role to be doing the presidential primary. There's no need to rush. We have a few years before another election will be held, and I thank you for your time.
Ms. Gogan, do you believe that, I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Carey, do you believe that the state law right now favors the political parties by disallowing your city council to meet on precinct caucus night?
It does not affect my city because they meet on a Monday.
I know, but
it could affect other cities.
There are 72 cities that do a. That,
during our special election, we actually had to ask one of our school districts to hold their school board meeting on a different night. So any election, whether it's a caucus, a primary, or a general election, they can't meet.
So in a way, it at least 72 cities, and under special circumstances, we do abide by the notion that the government caters to the private interests of the political parties.
Yes.
Any other questions? This has been an extremely warm, committee room tonight. It's not usually like that, and I apologize. I don't know why the heat is like this. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, for Senator Larson or whomever, I am not as much concerned about whether we have a primary or don't have a primary, except if we're going to have one and we're going to spend the money, and I think the state should appropriate the money, making it a primary that's meaningful and not a beauty contest or whatever we call it. And as Dr. Pearson's column and several others have pointed out, we can't make them binding. The parties have to do that. So I guess this is maybe partly a suggestion, and that is that if you are working with the parties and trying to convince them to make it meaningful, which would be, in my mind, make it a totally different question than one that's non-binding. If you were trying to work with the parties and do it, you might have better luck doing something to make it a closed primary other than what was done last time, because the closed primary last time, I know a lot of people here were really thrilled because we got names and we knew who was members of a certain party, and recognizing that the public is not real comfortable doing that, you could deal with it the same way when you vote, you're signing a pledge that you are who you say you are and so on. I don't know if any other states do this, but you could always leave it the option that I swear that I will only vote in a party of which I consider myself a member. I know the DFL precinct caucus sign, and you're signing a pledge that you consider yourself to be a member of the party and expect to be voting mainly for Democrats in the election. You could have a pledge where nobody in the public, no candidates, no media, no anybody else could find out what party you actually voted in, but you would still be restricted that way. The parties may, I mean, it's up to them, but they may find that acceptable to them because it is closed. It's closed in the same way that the caucuses are. You have to sign in that you consider yourself, you're taking a pledge, an oath that you are a member of that party. So if you're going to be working with the parties and trying to get them to agree to make something meaningful, I think you're going to have to do something to make it so it's not an open primary. And that might be one way you could do it without offending people who don't want to disclose who they support. Again, I'm really open to looking at it if it's a primary that means something, but as I said last year, I'm not really excited about spending money, whether it's state money or local government money, of $3.5 million for a thing that we could get about the same results by taking a poll. This is just my advice to you if you are looking for trying to make it meaningful.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Marty. And I should begin by saying that I have, very quickly after the Tuesday's events, reached out to the both Chairman Melendez and spoke with him, and also Chair Kerry, both the parties that have presidential candidates, and asked for their input. That is a standing invitation and desire to incorporate their concerns into how we move forward on this bill. I agree that given that this is a party activity, we do have to be sensitive to their desires that, in fact, in the Democratic primary, Democrats are voting in the Democratic primary and perhaps are willing to sign a pledge that says they are that possibly have their names available to the public. I think that may well be reasonable without having to have a full registration system where someone has to register themselves as a Democrat and to vote in a different primary 10 years later to need to change that registration. I think there's a way to have a hybrid in that, but for us to also protect the parties. The one other thing that I would like to address as it relates to the cost is, and I'm not insensitive to the cost, and this committee and the Finance Committee was very mindful because we chose not to move forward last year because of the cost. However, I do think one of the core functions of government is the system by which we elect our leaders. And while this is a party nominating system, it is clear, as I said before, the parties have moved toward wanting to hold an election. And when you see the things that I think all of us saw happen at the caucuses last Tuesday, where folks were receiving ballots on Post-it notes and were putting them into Kleenex boxes, again, I don't want this to sound like a criticism because I think the volunteers across Minnesota did a wonderful job, but they couldn't have anticipated that outcome. We have a state-of-the-art election system in Minnesota that could prevent the kinds of inadvertent, whether Senator Rest asked many questions tonight about whether someone had ended up in the wrong caucus, signed in perhaps in the wrong caucus, and maybe voted in the wrong precinct. That doesn't occur in our election system. We have those protections in place. So as it relates to the cost, I want us to keep in mind that having our elections be fair and honorable is also very, very important to our system. And I don't want us to let that get lost in the cost.
Final comment, Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, just two clarification points. One, I agree with you. I think we should spend whatever it costs to have good, fair, clean elections. My point is a meaningless primary, a beauty contest, whatever you want to call it, that's not binding, to me, is not worth $3 million or $1 million. If it's binding, I think it's worth it. And then the other one is the clarification of what I was suggesting in terms of registration. I wasn't just saying you sign and so you don't have to register. I'm saying you sign an oath that you will vote only in the party, which you do, and you get one ballot that has both parties on it, and you just pledge to vote in the party that you choose, which is roughly what happens now in our September primaries. You would only be allowed to vote in the primary. You'd be signing an oath that you're only voting in the primary you consider yourself a member of, but nobody would know. The election judge wouldn't know where you voted, nor would your neighbors, nor would your legislative candidates. Not one that anybody could even check on in any way, because you'd be handed a ballot that has both on and the secret ballot nobody'd know. So that's the point if you want to get around the concern that that people legitimately are scared. I mean, there are lots of people because of employment, and news media people say they can't vote in a primary because they don't want people to know.
Okay.
Madam Chair, just briefly, if I could respond to Senator
Marty.
Senator
Larson, we're...
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I said, very briefly. And I held my comments tonight because I knew I'd get a swing. So, and you've been very fair. But I just want to just briefly respond that I think there are many options for us to consider, and I think that's going to be the challenge before the committee, is to find what Minnesotans are most comfortable with. I think we're in a little bit of a difficult situation as it relates to binding, a primary being meaningful, because I think the parties aren't going to agree to a binding primary until they see what it looks like. They can sort of touch it, feel it, and look at it. Yet it's difficult for us to do that and expect the parties to bind that result. I think we have to have a little bit of faith in moving forward that if we put a system in place, make it meaningful to the public that they can show up and participate, as that participation grows, parties are going to realize that recognizing that outcome and that turnout of support for that party is going to be important for them. And so I think it's going to be hard for us to have that deal cut from day one. I think we're going to have to move forward and see how it goes. But my desire is that in the end we have parties wanting to bind their delegates based on the outcome of that presidential primary election. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Senator Larson, and for the members to join once again in this discussion. As you know, we have had this bill before us previously. It is now before us again. We're not taking action on it. Therefore, this bill is whatever the number is, Senate File 1527, is laid over for further consideration. There being no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much.